You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, one of which will be coming up this month. More than half a century ago, the blacklisted Hollywood screenwriter Dalton Trumbo produced a small pamphlet which he titled The Time of the Toad. It was a reference to a statement by the 19th-century French novelist Émile Zola that before he began to read what the French press had to say every morning, he would eat a toad. After that, said Zola, he could swallow almost anything. It seems that for some time we have been living in the time of the toad, with the national media more than a match in its mendacity to what Zola and the people of France had to deal with in another age. I should add that I have a loyal listener, a KZOX member, who refers to me as the dentist, because most of the news I bring to you on Takes on the World is invariably painful. After watching the results come in from last night's primaries and hearing the inane, contentless comments of the media pundits, as well as those of the presumptive presidential candidates, it seems this is going to be another one of those painful days. Later this morning, after telling you about a few things that you're unlikely to hear anywhere else on your radio dial, I'll be taking a look at one of the less attractive aspects of American society, not disconnected from the one we are currently experiencing, that is the presidential election process. It's one that Bernie Sanders has spoken about on the campaign trail, and one which his opponent, the now presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her husband, ex-President Bill, contributed to mightily in creating. It is America as the incarceration nation. Incarceration Nation, How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World, is the title of a newly published book by Cornell University professor Peter Enns, and I'll be discussing its contents with him about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. My painful week began early Monday when NPR's Morning Edition host David Greene asked radio host Nomiki Konst, a Bernie Sanders supporter, to share her opinions on the California Democratic presidential primary with Cokie Roberts, a long-established Washington political figure who is a fixture on NPR most Monday mornings. If you were listening, you heard an exchange between the Sanders supporter Konst, host of Sirius XM Radio's The Filter, and Greene, in which the following comment by Konst perked up my ears. "You know," she said, "California by design in the 80s, if many listeners may recall, there was a Hunt Commission, which was sort of the counter-reform effort after a few reform commissions. And at this Hunt Commission, the establishment spoke up and said, you know, we want to have our say in the party as well, not just the voters. And that's when they came up with the idea of superdelegates. And they also put some of these primaries, the more conservative states at the beginning of the process, and more liberal states like California all the way at the end. So even though California is the largest state, by far the most progressive state," she added, "it was put at the end to prevent a more progressive grassroots candidate, and that was actually spoken of at the commission, from taking the nomination," end quote. A remarkable statement that surely should have drawn a response other than what followed from NPR's Greene and Roberts, in that they are dealing with a problem that I had never heard before discussed on the air. "Well, what about those who would say the system, maybe it should be changed," interjected Greene. "Bernie Sanders could take that fight to future elections, but not this one. He's playing by the rules that are established. And you know, at the moment, you know, some would argue the numbers are stacked up against him. And as Cokie said, you know, numbers-wise, California doesn't matter." When Greene asked for her comments on what Nomiki Konst said, Roberts expressed not a word of sympathy or any indication that California's situation might be unjust. "Look," she said, "if you don't like the way the rules are, you could do what Jesse Jackson did in 1988 when he had won 13 states and he went to the Democratic convention and said, get rid of winner-take-all primaries and change the system to proportional, which is what happened," end quote. Yep, and what they gave the voters were the superdelegates. Well, if we have learned anything from this strange election season is that age does not necessarily make us wiser when it comes to political issues, and that there's nothing democratic about the Democratic Party. The party establishment will not give up its power without a fight, and that's what we're likely to witness in Philadelphia next month. Last Friday saw the passing from Parkinson's disease of one of the most widely recognized figures of our time, former heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Most of those who have publicly mourned his passing on the mainstream media, however, are doing the same number on him they did on Dr. Martin Luther King since the moment of his assassination, ignoring King's unconditional condemnation of the Vietnam War and our foreign interventions, and identifying America as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. In acknowledging Ali's passing, Obama spoke in general terms. He said his fight outside the ring would cost him his title, his public standing, noted the president. It would earn him enemies on the left and the right, make him reviled, and nearly send him to jail, said Obama. But Ali stood his ground, and his victory helped us to get used to the America we recognize today, end quote. I beg to differ, Mr. President. Ali's denunciation of the Vietnam War did not make him enemies on the left. Quite the contrary. Throughout much of the world, he became a hero for the ages. And to make sure there'd be no other draft resistors such as Ali and the thousands of others who refused to go to that unjust war, names known now only to their families, friends, and the FBI, President Nixon ended the draft in 1973. It was a master stroke on Nixon's part. Not only did it take the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement, but the establishment of a volunteer, higher-paid military precluded the development of popular movements against the wars that were yet to come, the wars we have today. A last word about Muhammad Ali that you will not be told or read about in the mainstream media or hear mentioned at his memorial service. He was an outspoken critic of Israel and a supporter of the Palestinian cause. In March 1974, for example, he told a press conference in Beirut at the start of a tour of the Middle East that the United States is a stronghold of Zionism and imperialism. On a visit afterward to two Palestinian refugee camps in southern Lebanon, as reported by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, he was reported by a Palestinian news outlet as saying, and quote, "In my name and the name of all Muslims in America, I declare support for the Palestinian struggle to liberate their homeland and now the Zionist invaders," end quote. I have since learned to my disgust that Ali's memorial service this Friday in his Lexington, Kentucky birthplace, that the eulogy will be delivered by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, the incarcerator, whose anti-crime legislation, hardly endorsed by First Lady Hillary, led to the imprisonment of thousands of black and brown youth, many unjustly, largely for drug crimes. In addition to family members and representatives of six religious faiths, Turkey's increasingly dictatorial president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Jordan's King Abdullah will be among the speakers. Thus far, it appears that not a single voice in the black political community will have an opportunity to speak to the 18,000 who are expected to attend the event at the KFC Yum Arena. It may be that none wanted to share the stage with Clinton, but it's more likely the organizers wanted to continue the process of sanitizing Ali's radical history. In the same category, we could include the failure of the country's largest veterans organizations, all of our flag-waving politicians, and the nation's media to mention that today is the 49th anniversary of Israel's deadly and deliberate attack on the USS Liberty, a clearly marked Navy intelligence ship that was monitoring radio traffic off the coast of Egypt during Israel's Six-Day War in June 1967. For 75 minutes on a Sunday afternoon, 3 days into the war, Israeli jets and torpedo boats ruthlessly pounded and napalmed the lightly armed American ship, killing 34 sailors and wounding another 171 after first destroying its highly sophisticated communication systems. The Israeli claim that its flyers mistook the Liberty for a much smaller Egyptian vessel, which few senior U.S. officials accepted, was exposed as a blanket lie in 2007 with the release of declassified transcripts of Israeli radio traffic that the NSA had recorded and kept secret for 40 years. That story should have been on the front page of every newspaper in this country, but only the Chicago Tribune reported it, and you were listening to Takes on the World, you heard it about right here. Even a bigger story was the betrayal of the crew of the Liberty by President Lyndon Johnson. But that, too, the American public still knows nothing about. One of the Liberty's distress cables had managed to get through when the Israeli fighters were reloading, and the USS Saratoga, the closest U.S. aircraft carrier to the war zone, picked it up. The ship's commander, Admiral Geist, responded by sending a fleet of jets toward the Liberty's location, and he let the Defense Department know about it. At that time, the nationality of the attacking force was unknown, but when the White House learned they were Israelis, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara wired Admiral Geist to tell his flyers to turn around and abort the mission. Disbelieving what he had been told, Admiral Geist then phoned McNamara and asked him if the president knew about the orders. At that point, Johnson himself came on the line, Geist recalled, and told the stunned admiral that it was his orders, saying, "I don't want to embarrass an ally," end quote, by end quote. By any definition of the word, that was an act of treason on the part of President Johnson, for which he should have been arrested, removed from office, and tried for his betrayal of the country and the men in uniform for whom he was commander-in-chief. To compound his crime, he ordered the ship's survivors not to mention a word of it to the media on the penalty of court-martial. Thus, it was not until he retired did the ship's bridge officer, Lieutenant Commander James Ennis, write the first book about the attack, called The Assault on the Liberty, which you can buy or read online, along with a number of books, other books, plus two excellent documentaries on the subject. What was the reason for the attack? There's much speculation, but what seems likely is that since the Israelis had obtained the location of all of Syria's defenses on the Golan Heights through a major spying operation, they wanted to take advantage of the war to destroy those defenses and seize the Golan Heights, which they did, again, reportedly, the wishes of the White House, and so wished to keep it secret until the deed was done. Israel's attack on the USS Liberty, on our liberty, if you will, came to define U.S.-Israel relations, establishing as a fact that the Israelis could murder Americans, American servicemen and women, and get away with it. Further evidence of that has been the years of failed efforts by USS Liberty survivors to get Congress to conduct a single investigation of the incident, which they have compared with Congress's obsessive response to the attack in Benghazi. Up to Israel's launching of the war in Egypt, France had been its major arms supplier. The U.S. contribution was limited to Hawk anti-aircraft missiles, which President Kennedy had provided Israel as a bribe to keep it from developing nuclear weapons, a bribe that didn't work. French President Charles de Gaulle had warned Israel not to instigate an attack, and when it did, he promptly cut off all further arms shipments. That's when the Johnson administration stepped in. Rather than punishing Israel, he rewarded it. It's one of the reasons I suspect behind Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu telling a group of Jewish settlers in 2001 that, quote, "America is a thing you can move very easily," end quote. He's still doing it, as this next piece of news illustrates, one that's posing problems for Washington and the U.S. media. Used to catering to Israel's interest while at the same time projecting Russian President Vladimir Putin as a threat to invade Eastern Europe, the White House and the mainstream media are having their difficulties in explaining the cozy relations between Netanyahu and Putin that have developed over the past year. How will the neocons candidate Hillary Clinton do it? Well, at the moment, they can't, which might explain why there has been so little U.S. coverage of the latest visit to Moscow of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his fourth in less than a year. This one with his wife Sarah began on Monday, ostensibly to mark the 25th anniversary of the reestablishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries, but with a loaded working agenda designed to bring Moscow and Tel Aviv closer together. According to Netanyahu's office, he and Putin will discuss with the implementation of certain understandings that they reached during his visit to Moscow this past April, along with examining the various regional issues, including, quote, the global fight against terrorism, situation in and around Syria, and the diplomatic horizon between Israel and the Palestinians, end quote. They'll be talking about bilateral economic and trade cooperation and the strengthening of, quote, cultural and humanitarian ties. Primary interest in Netanyahu is signing an agreement that starting in 2017 will see earlier emigres from the USSR, former USSR, who lost their eligibility for Russian pensions, having them reinstated, a move designed to enhance Netanyahu's credibility within Israel's large right-wing Russian Jewish community. One highlight of the visit will be the return to Israel of a tank captured intact by the Syrian army in eastern Lebanon at the beginning of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Its crew became frightened when it came under attack and apparently abandoned the tank and attempted to get back to Israel on foot. They never made it, and their parents are still wondering what became of them. That's what a New York Times article about Netanyahu's trip focused on, ignoring the political implications of the warming relationship between America's loyal ally in the Middle East and its latest major global adversary. This first became noticeable when Israel refused to back U.S.-led sanctions on Russia after it annexed Crimea in 2014, a fact that the White House, the rabidly anti-Russia neocons, and the mainstream have successfully kept from the American public up to now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوسا.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. Again this week, we have a full-featured program. In November of 2015, the Boston University Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine held a conference featuring Middle East scholar, author, and activist Muin Rabbani and author and professor Norman Finkelstein, who have just authored a book together on solving the Israel-Palestine conflict. Last week, we heard Muin Rabbani's presentation, where he focused on Palestine's moving from the suffocation of the Oslo peace process to a strategy of more reliance on the United Nations and the international community in search of support for ending the Israeli occupation. He stressed that any resolution of the conflict will depend on Palestine getting their political house in order and recognition secured in international law to their right of return to their land and property. This week, we hear from Norman Finkelstein. Here is Norman Finkelstein speaking at Boston University.
Well, I want to resume where Muin left off, in particular on two points. I'll begin with the last one, which is, as Muin said, you don't know where things are headed. It's a moment which is pregnant with possibility, but it could all be aborted very quickly. It may last for years, or it may even turn into just a fleeting moment. We really don't know. And that's all the more reason why we have to concentrate our energy now. Because if you miss a historical moment, then you miss a huge historic possibility. And then the conflict can just drag on and on and on and on. And so we have to do all in our power to capitalize on that moment, which for all we know might not last all that long. Now, having said that, Muin also remarked that as promising as possibilities might be, he said that it has to be embedded in a strategy. You can't carry on in a random, unfocused fashion. There has to be a strategy And as he said, one of the aspects of the strategy is to mobilize people. That's the goal, to reach out to a public, not only in Europe, but a public even in the United States, that the first time in living memory is ready to listen. If you look at the polls, not just in Europe, but also in North America, Israel's stock has significantly declined. I wouldn't say as in Europe, it's plummeted, and it has in Europe consistently in polls taken by the BBC World Service. Israel over the last 10 years has been consistently, if we can use the word, lumped together with Iran, Pakistan, and North Korea as having the most negative influence in the world, in every country in Europe, virtually every country in Europe. It's not true that public opinion has become so hostile to Israel and the United States, but it is true that public opinion has significantly changed. So to take the most recent example, two polls were taken, one by Pew, one by the BBC, both very reputable polling agencies. Two polls were taken on the attitudes among many countries, including the United States, on the question of Palestinian statehood. Now, of the countries polled, every single one, bar none, in every single country polled, either a plurality or a majority supported Palestinian statehood. That's not altogether surprising, except that when I say every single country polled, surprisingly, that included the United States, where a plurality, approximately 45% of Americans said they supported the Palestinian bid for statehood, and depending on the poll, 24 or 36% opposed it. Now, you have to appreciate, as only an American can, how remarkable that is, because the President of the United States, Mr. Obama, was dead set against Palestinian statehood. Both houses of Congress passed resolutions condemning Palestinian statehood. Both political parties condemned Palestinian statehood, and the full gamut of the mainstream media opposed Palestinian statehood. Nonetheless, a plurality of Americans managed to see through the lies, see through the misinformation and disinformation, and supported its statehood. And you can cite many other polls which give similar indication that public opinion in the U.S. is changing, and not just among Americans in general, but public opinion among American Jews in particular. It's also significantly changed. And for reasons which are fairly obvious, on a moment's reflection, because American Jews are overwhelmingly liberal. Since at least the 1930s, American Jews have overwhelmingly voted for the Democratic Party, and on all polls that are taken, American Jews define themselves on the spectrum of conservative, moderate, liberal. American Jews define themselves in percentages as liberal, much higher than any other ethnic or religious group in the United States. If you look at the last presidential election, 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. Latinos, who came in third, first African Americans, who was over 90%, American Jews 80%, Latinos was about 63% voted for Mr. Obama. Now, if you factor in income, American Jews now being by far and away the wealthiest religious ethnic group in the U.S., they should be voting Republican if you vote by your pocketbook, as most people do. But no, American Jews are liberal. They vote Democratic. And liberal in the United States, it generally means belief in the rule of law, belief in equality before the law, belief in international institutions, belief in the peaceful resolution of a conflict. That's what liberal means in the American context. And the simple fact is, American Jews now know too much. They can no longer reconcile their liberal convictions, their liberal tenets, their liberal beliefs with the way Israel carries on. It's simply not possible any longer to reconcile. And it's particularly true among young American Jews, those who attend schools like Boston University, where you're young, you're Jewish, you're idealistic, you're liberal, which is the profile, overwhelmingly, of college age American Jews, young, liberal, idealistic. Well, if you fit that profile, as most American Jewish college students do, you don't want to have to go before the public. In 2006, during the Israeli attack on Lebanon, they dropped in the last 72 hours of the war, when a UN resolution had already been passed and the ceasefire was supposed to go into effect. And Israel used the last 72 hours to drop 4 million cluster bomblets on South Lebanon. You're young, you're Jewish, you're liberal, you're idealistic. You don't want to defend that. You're young, you're Jewish, you're liberal, you're idealistic. During Israel's invasion of Gaza in 2008-09, they dropped white phosphorus, a substance that reaches 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. They dropped it in two hospitals. You're Jewish. You don't want to have to defend that. If you're Rush Limbaugh's son, Sarah Palin's daughter, Michelle Bachman's whatever, is she still around? Kane is getting all the headlines now, so I know. If you're them, yeah, you'll defend it. You know, some people will defend breaking the kneecaps of nuns, but it's not a Jewish thing. And so all the polls show that there has been a steady decline in American Jewish support for Israel and among younger Jews ages 40 and under. There has been a significant decline, so much so that there's a vast amount of literature now talking about how to, among the Jewish community, talking about how to reverse this significant decline. And you can see it at work in the universities, even in your own school. There was a time when Israel IDF soldiers used to tour the universities to be celebrated, in particular by the Jewish students, as war heroes. But in more recent years, the college Hillels, they drag the IDF soldiers on tours, with the purpose of the tours is to try to convince Jewish students that they aren't war criminals. It's changed. And Israel and its propaganda outfits and its lobby, they know the battle has been lost. And that's why they desperately work behind the scenes to try to get events like this one canceled, because they know they cannot any longer win the battle for public opinion. They have lost in the court of public opinion. And so they work behind the scenes, making all sorts of threats about withholding alumni funds and feeling unsafe when this or that speaker comes. All of these kinds of petty, silly tactics in order to suppress any open discussion, because they know in any open discussion it's a lost cause. They've lost. And so now we have the opportunity of trying to build a movement, trying, as Muin said, to develop a strategy, develop goals, and, as he said, mobilize people to try for once and for all to put this conflict behind us. Because a kind of sentiment has settled in that this thing will never end. And I think there is an opportunity now, and we have to change our mindset. The mindset which we've had for decades now, and regrettably I have to say decades now, that mindset needs to be changed. I see Susan Akram in the audience, who I first met, I'm afraid to say, about 30 years we're heading. Where are we now? 21 years ago. Muin, we're coming on 30 years, because I think it was about 85, right? Yeah. And it's sort of like, it's gonna just continue. On and on and on. But I think now there is a possibility to reach a resolution and turn the Israel-Palestine conflict not into a subject of current events, but a subject of history, a past event. And we really have to believe that, not as an act of faith, but believe it because there are new possibilities. And then the question is, okay, what's the strategy? How do you mobilize people? And here it seems to me a useful person to look at to provide some insight and guidance is to look at the Mahatma, Mr. Gandhi, because he faced a challenge not unlike the one the Palestinians confront. India was trying to end an occupation, and the occupation was by the most formidable military and economic and political power of its day, namely the British. And the Palestinians are also trying to end an occupation, and of the immediate adversary is a regional power. The overarching adversary is the leading political economic power of our day, namely the United States. So how do you begin? What do you do? Well, I did take some time a couple of years ago to plow through a large part of Mr. Gandhi's collected works, which are quite substantial. They run to 100 volumes, 500 pages a volume. Gandhi had a lot to say. In fact, not mostly about politics in a narrow sense. Most of his collected works are given over to diet and health. He was a kind of a premature Oprah, but with a rather narrower waistline. And don't let the pictures in the cover for a magazine fool you. It's a miracle what you can do with the angle on lenses. In any event, I did go through a large part of his collected works, and I think he had a lot of quite useful insight, some of which bears directly on the topic of my part of this evening's lecture. And the most important insight, I think, from Gandhi was that politics is not about trying to change public opinion. You're not trying to bring enlightenment to the benighted masses. Politics is about trying to get people to act on what they already know is wrong. And everybody has that experience. You get up in the morning, and from the moment the day begins to the moment the day ends, you look around you, that's wrong, that's just not right, that's unfair, that shouldn't be. There are 1,000 things that we already know are wrong, but we don't act on them, including myself. And for Gandhi, the art of politics is to stimulate people to act on what they already know is wrong. The purpose of nonviolent civil disobedience was trying, as he called it, to quicken the conscience, the dead conscience of the public into action. So I see that Susan has a perplexed look in her eyes, and I do try to give concrete examples because abstractions rarely have an impact. So concretely, what does that mean? Well, I go jogging in my neighborhood, and there's an overpass along the boulevard. And underneath the overpass, every winter, there are always Mexican workers sleeping there. And every time I pass them, every time I make a resolution, it must be at least a decade now, I make the resolution, I'm going to give them one of my winter coats. Because they're buried underneath these raggedy, dirty blankets. And as it happens, I have a closet full of winter coats. I have one going all the way back when I was 16. It was a Mighty Mac. And it was a mighty good winter coat, which is why I've kept it. Do you remember the Mighty Mac? No, the older people won't remember. You, I'm asking. Do you remember it? No. Okay. You're obviously not from the United States. You're an alien. Well, I have all these old winter coats, but as many times as I resolve, I'm going to give them a winter coat. I just never do. I never follow up on what I know is wrong. Now, I know, knowing me, that were it the case that 30 or 40 people were to block the boulevard where I live and were saying we're committing this act of nonviolent civil disobedience to try to shake the conscience of people, to remind them there are all these homeless people who are in these frigid temperatures, and they need coats. And if somebody were to do that, or some people were to do that, I know I'd be the first one out there carrying not one, but at least five of my winter coats and giving them to the homeless. And that's what Gandhi said politics is about. Trying to get people to act on what they already know is wrong. But there's one qualification. The qualification is that not only must your means be just, that is, nobody can find exception to using nonviolent civil disobedience, not only must your means be just, but in the public's eye, your goal also has to be just. If they don't agree with your goal, then however just your means are, you will never get people to act. So what does that mean concretely? Well, let's take the case of the United States. Most public opinion polls show that Americans are divided right down the middle on the question of abortion. 50% are pro-choice, 50% are pro-life. So let's just imagine doing a thought experiment. If the 50% of Americans who are pro-life, all of them were to converge on the abortion clinics in the United States, and they said, we are going to fast unto the death until these physicians stop performing abortions. Their means, no reasonable person can quarrel with. They are absolutely nonviolent, and they entail the maximum in personal sacrifice. But if I were to ask, are you pro-choice? No, the woman in front of you. Yes. So if I were to ask you, if these people said they were going to fast unto the death, until these abortions stop, would that move you? No. And she shakes her head emphatically, no. Of course not. She's probably thinking, I hope they fast until the death, and I hope they drop dead. Which tells you that it's not just means that will reach a public. It's also just ends, goals. And so in order to try, as Muin said, to set a strategy that mobilizes people, we have to be very careful that we set ourselves a goal that will reach people. If you overreach in your goal, you're going to lose people. And if you overreach in your goal, instead of creating a movement, you're simply going to build a cult. Instead of building a movement, you're going to end up creating a cult. The two are very different. Mr. Gandhi, most of you know his political life as a leader of the Indian independence movement. But he had a second simultaneous life. He was an ashram leader. And in his ashram, which is like a cult, in his ashram, he was very strict. He was a very strict taskmaster. No meat, obviously, because he's a vegetarian. No sex, brahmacharya. But no underwear. He thought that was a Western idea. No joking while doing chores. No reading in the toilet. No wrist watches. And he enforced this on every member of his ashram. And he used to have them keep a book. What do you do every minute of every day? Because he thought there was nothing more sinful than squandering time. And he would read the book. He was a little big brother. But Gandhi was smart and shrewd enough a politician to recognize that you couldn't use the standard of an ashram if you want to build a mass movement among the Indian people. It's a different standard. Having said that, what should be the standard of the Palestine movement? And here I think the answer is very straightforward and uncontroversial. Because if you look at every representative body in the world today, every representative political body in the world today, or if you look at the most respected political bodies in the world today, whichever angle you look at it, from the most representative to the most respected, you come to the same conclusion. The whole of international public opinion, in its most democratic and its most progressive forums, they've embraced the two-state settlement on the June 1967 border, a full Israeli withdrawal from the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, including, in the case of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and what's called a just resolution of the refugee question. So, because time is limited, let's just take a couple of examples. So if I were to ask you, what's the most representative political body in the world today, you would say, yeah, the United Nations General Assembly. And every year the UN General Assembly votes in a resolution titled Peaceful Resolution of the Palestine Question. Actually, it votes literally this minute every year, the end of November. I'm not sure what the vote is this year. It usually comes out in early December. In any case, they vote on a two-state settlement, full Israeli withdrawal, just settlement of the Palestinian refugee question. To give you the typical votes across the past decade, 1997, the vote, 155-2, the whole world on one side, Israel and the United States on the other side. 2004, the vote, 161-7, the whole world on one side, Israel, the U.S., Australia, Grenada, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau on the other side. 2010, this past year, the vote, 165-7, the whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, Australia, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau on the other side. For those of you who are laughing, I know that sound of the embarrassed laughter. You hear Nauru and Palau, funny names, but you don't know what they are, and you're college educated, so you're a little bit embarrassed. Truth be told, I didn't know much about them either. I can tell you without trying to disparage small countries that their entire populations can easily fit in the empty seats in this room with room left over. And also in the case of these countries, because of global warming, they probably will not be voting in any more of these UN. No, that's not, you shouldn't be applauding that. Some of you are thinking, but what about those Arab countries, those terrible, anti-Semitic, crazy, fanatical Arab countries? And yes, there are 22 of those countries in the world that belong to this organization called the Arab League. And the Arab League, in March 2002, it put forth what's come to be called the Arab Peace Initiative. And the Arab Peace Initiative says we support a two-state settlement in the June 1967 border, a just resolution of the refugee question, echoing the sentiment of the United Nations General Assembly. Then some of you are thinking, what about those Muslim countries? And indeed, there are 57 Muslim countries. They belong to the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And the Organization of the Islamic Conference, it too adopted the Arab Peace Initiative supporting a two-state settlement in the June 67 border, just resolution of the refugee question. And it's important to bear in mind that among the members of the OIC, those 57 Muslim countries, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has supported the two-state settlement on the June 67 border and the just resolution of the refugee question. And since 2004, if you look at the UN General Assembly vote, and I urge you to do so on your own, it's the resolution, I'll repeat, is entitled Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. You'll see Iran, since 2004, has been voting with the majority, voting with the rest of the world, apart from the U.S., Israel, Micronesia, Nauru, and Palau. If that's the most representative body in the world, then if I were to ask, what is the most respected legal body in the world, you would respond, well, ask Susan because she teaches law. The International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice, consisting of 15 judges from representative countries in the world. And in fact, the International Court of Justice in 2004, it rendered what's called an advisory opinion on the Israel-Palestine conflict. I don't have time now to go through the context of the opinion it rendered, but let me go through very quickly some of the substantive results of their opinion, which are relevant to this. Number one, the International Court of Justice ruled that the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, these are occupied Palestinian territories. These are the areas which, as the court put it, are designated for Palestinian self-determination. Number two, the International Court of Justice ruled that East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It is exactly in its legal status the same as the West Bank and Gaza. It is a part of the designated unit for Palestinian self-determination. Number three, the International Court of Justice ruled that all the settlements are illegal, all the Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, all 500,000 settlers, they are all illegal under international law. They are a flagrant violation of international law. Now, bear in mind what that means. Because every time you open the newspaper or you turn on the radio and you listen to the dreadful NPR or the dreadful BBC, they always refer to the occupied territories as the disputed territories. But according to the highest judicial body in the world, there's no dispute whatsoever. These are occupied Palestinian territories. If you listen to the radio, read the newspaper, they'll tell you that the settlements are controversial. But in fact, there's no controversy whatsoever about the legal status of those settlements. None at all. All the settlements under international law are illegal under international law. Now, I want to give you some sense about how lacking in controversy these issues are. We're told settlements, Jerusalem, borders, and I'll get to in a moment, the refugees, we're told these are such controversial issues that they have to be put off, deferred to the end of negotiations, because they're so controversial that negotiations will break down if we start talking about them immediately. They're called the final status issues, or sometimes the permanent status issues. Controversial? Well, let's look at that court opinion. There are 15 judges in that court. Two of them, incidentally, are Jewish. Rosalind Higgins from the UK, she's married to an Irishman, and Thomas Bergenfeld, the American judge, who's a Holocaust survivor and Jewish. On the points to which I just referred, borders, Jerusalem, settlements, not a single judge, not one, on the International Court of Justice registered a dissent. Not one. On the broader issue that the court was addressing, which I can't get into now, the legality of the wall that Israel is building in the West Bank, the vote was 14-1. The negative vote was cast by the American judge, Bergenfeld. But even Bergenfeld said in his opinion, he wrote a separate opinion, not a dissent, he wrote a separate opinion. Even Bergenfeld said in his separate opinion, there's much in what the majority said that I agree with. And he said, I have to agree with the majority that the settlements are illegal under international law. There's no controversy. For those of you who follow the International Court of Justice, it's very unusual. These are very independent-minded, you could say contentious judges. But when it came to these issues, there was no dissent. And there was no dissent because there's nothing controversial at all about them in the law. They are just very straightforward issues of law. And that leaves the last question, the question of the refugees. Now, it's true that the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, didn't address it because it wasn't relevant to what they were adjudicating, but the major human rights organizations have addressed it. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, in 2000-2001, they issued opinion papers and policy statements on the question of the refugees. And both Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, they both agreed that under international law, the Palestinians and what they called their terms, succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land, the original Palestinian refugees, and succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land, that they have the right of return. So, there are two conclusions that follow from what I have to say. The first conclusion is that this is the consensus of international opinion, both in its most representative and its respected bodies. This is where international opinion is at. It calls for a two-state settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict on this June 67 border and a just resolution of the refugee question. The first conclusion is, on every significant issue, bearing on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the Israeli position has no standing whatsoever. They have lost in the court of public opinion. Their position has been repudiated across the board. That is, you might say, the bright side of the picture. There is a broad public that's ready to hear a simple message. The message is, enforce the law. That's what we want to do. We want to enforce the law. But there's a second conclusion, which is, in my opinion, just as important as the first. It is important trying to reach the broad public. The second conclusion is important in terms of ourselves, that is, people who are activists in the movement. And that is, the law is clear. Israel is a member state of the United Nations. It has the same rights and obligations as any other member state. And therefore, from the point of view of the law, if you're talking about enforcing the law, that means two states. Does not mean one state. There's nothing in the law and nothing in the representative institutions that speaks about one state. Now, some of you might feel, well, I don't agree with that. I think it's wrong. And truth be told, probably you can make a very compelling argument saying why it's wrong. But in my opinion, that's not politics. Because politics is not about your opinion or your opinion or your opinion or my opinion. That's not politics. Politics is about, exactly as Gandhi put it, it's where public opinion is at, where you can reach them. And the thing about politics is, if you overreach public opinion, you end up in a cult. So, a concrete example. I told you, if 20 people blocked that boulevard in front of my house and said, we're trying to awaken the conscience of people to give their coats, I would do it. I know it. I know me. But wait, I'm no saint. If they blocked the boulevard and they said, not to give your coat, but to give a room in your house to the homeless, well, I'll tell you, I think the person who says that has the moral argument on his or her side. If we want to use the proverbial standard, what would Jesus do? Well, I think Jesus would say, give your room. I do. And I'm not proud to have to say, I won't do it. I'm ready to give my coat. I do have room in my apartment. I can't lie about that. I do. And sometimes I get very torn and twisted inside me. I think I really should give that room, but I won't. And if the people block the boulevard and demanded the room, they lose the public. Even if morally they have the stronger argument. And I think it's the same thing here. You can make 1,000 morally compelling arguments why it should be one state. And probably you'd have a lot of right on your side, and you may be able to best me in the argument. But that's not what politics is about. Politics is about where public opinion is at. And if we don't want to lapse into a cult, and more importantly, if we want to take advantage, exploit that political opportunity that's opened up for us, we have to be very careful about gauging our goal to reach public opinion, but not to so overreach it that we miss the opportunity.
You have been listening to Norman Finkelstein speaking at Boston University on solving the Israeli-Palestine conflict. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Listening to episode 741 of Unwelcome Guests, Solving 9/11, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton, and we're going to spend the whole show this week on an audio book. This is a book by Chris Bullin, Solving 9/11, and it's read by the author.
Chapter 1, 9/11 Through the Eyes of an American Skeptic.
In December 2001, just 3 months after the attacks in New York, Eckhard Wirthbach, the former president of Germany's intelligence service, meeting with Christopher Bolin in Germany, said, "The deathly precision and magnitude of planning behind the 9/11 attacks would have needed years of planning. Such a sophisticated operation would require the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization, something not found in a loose group of terrorists like the ones allegedly led by Mohammed Atta while he studied in Hamburg. Many people would have been involved in the planning of such an operation. The absence of leaks is further indication that the attacks were state-organized actions."
As a journalist with an independent weekly newspaper based in Washington, D.C., I became caught up in the events of 9/11 from the minute it happened and was able to write freely about the terror attacks that were exploited to start the pre-planned war on terror. From my position as a skeptic of the unproven official version, I have examined the facts and evidence since the day it happened and have concluded that the U.S. government and controlled media have engaged in a conspiracy to deceive the world about what really happened on that terrible day. The dream. The early morning hours of September 11, 2001 found me with my family driving through New York City en route to Washington, D.C. after a weekend trip to Stowe, Vermont. We had visited the Trapp Family Lodge and gotten a late start from Stowe on Monday afternoon. By the time we reached New York City, our two small children were fast asleep in the back seat of the car. Because the hotels were either full or outrageously expensive, I was left with no choice but to continue driving down the highway when I should have been sleeping. To keep me awake as I drove through New York City, my wife Helia described a vivid dream she had had a week earlier, the night before we had left our home near Chicago. In her dream, we were driving toward a city with a skyline of densely packed skyscrapers when a large airplane flew right at us and plunged into the road about 50 meters in front of our car. She turned and saw the plane emerge from the ground behind us and another plane coming at us from another angle. This was a strange dream in which she felt that our family had been under attack. Helia's dream turned out to be an eerie and uncanny premonition of what was to happen in the skies of New York City less than 8 hours later. It was about 3 a.m. in the morning of September 11th when we finally found an affordable hotel room just inside the state of Maryland on Interstate 95. The kids woke up and jumped on the beds, and then we all fell asleep about a half hour later. I woke up about 8:30 a.m. and went down to the lobby for a cup of coffee. The television was on in the breakfast area, reporting that a plane had struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan. I grabbed some pastries and coffee and hurried back to the room and turned the television to the news channel. The children and I went to get more donuts and coffee and were on our way back to the room when the second plane hit the South Tower. Helia had seen it happen live on television. We were shocked by the events and realized that America was under attack. I immediately called my office in Washington, D.C., and told my boss that kamikaze airplanes had hit the World Trade Center. He thought I was joking. I said I wouldn't joke about such a thing and told him to turn on the radio. I called the office again after the Pentagon was hit and said we would not be coming to Washington, but were heading home to Chicago. Having no idea what would happen next, I thought it would be best to take the country roads and stay away from big cities. We drove through rural Lancaster County, past Amish farmers harvesting a very tall corn crop. I stopped and walked into the fields to ask some of the German-speaking farmers if they knew what had happened in New York City. They said they had not heard anything about it and carried on working with their horse-drawn harvester. Our route from Pennsylvania to Chicago took us near the site in Shanksville where Flight 93 supposedly crashed, but I had no desire to go to the scene of the disaster. We stopped for lunch in a small town. The diner was full of people, but nobody was talking. The people sat quietly, as if mesmerized, listening to the news on the radio. Indications of Israeli involvement. We listened to the radio as we drove across Pennsylvania. It was a beautiful sunny day with a bright blue sky. About noon, I heard a news report that 5 Middle Eastern men had been seen in New Jersey, videotaping and celebrating the destruction of the World Trade Center. Most people automatically associate Middle Eastern with Arab. This early news report immediately planted in the public mind the idea that Muslims were behind the terror attacks. This line of thinking quickly became the accepted explanation, and although it remains unproven, became the official version of 911. The first indication that the attack on the World Trade Center was an elaborate false flag operation came with the arrest of the five men on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River. These men, described as Middle Eastern in the first media reports, were later identified as Israelis. A false flag operation is a crime which is designed and carried out so that another party or nation is blamed. The five jubilant Middle Eastern men, who had filmed themselves smiling and celebrating with the burning World Trade Center in the background, were identified as Sivan and Paul Kurtzberg, Oded Elner, Omer Marmari, and Yaron Shmuel. Two of them were actually known to U.S. law enforcement as agents of Israeli intelligence, a fact that was ignored by the media. The Israelis had been observed taking video or photos of themselves with the World Trade Center burning in the background. Sivan Kurtzberg told the police that the men had been driving in their van in the immediate vicinity of the towers that morning. He was photographed flicking a lighter with the burning towers behind him. A woman who had observed the jubilant Israelis said she was struck by the expressions on the men's faces. "They were like happy, you know," she said. "They didn't look shocked to me. I thought it was very strange." When they were arrested, Sivan, the driver of the van, told the police, "We are Israeli. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are the problem." The story of the five men celebrating the destruction of the Twin Towers was dropped from the national news when it became known that they were not Arabs or Muslims from the Middle East, but Israelis. The noteworthy fact that these men, who clearly had prior knowledge of the attacks, were in fact Israelis, and that they had been arrested at gunpoint with box cutter knives, multiple passports, and thousands of dollars in cash, driving a van that tested positive for explosives, was only reported by Paulo Lima in a local New Jersey newspaper, the Bergen Record, the following day. This important information, however, was completely ignored by the New York Times and the other national mass media outlets based across the river in New York City. I discussed the details with Paulo Lima on the phone, and this important and suppressed story became the subject of my first article about 9/11. I realized then, during the first week after 9/11, that the mainstream news media was ignoring and covering up important information and evidence about the terrorist attacks. There would be, for example, no reporting in the mainstream media of the evidence of Israeli involvement or prior knowledge of the attacks. This was just the beginning of the censorship the media was to impose on the events of 9/11. The possibility that these men could be Israeli intelligence agents involved in a spectacular false flag terror attack was discussed in my article that went to print in American Free Press on September 20, 2001. Months later, Forward, a well-known New York-based Jewish newspaper, confirmed that Urban Moving Systems, the Weehawken, New Jersey-based moving company that the men worked for, was actually an Israeli intelligence front operation, and that at least two of the men, evidently the Kurtzberg brothers, were known agents of Mossad, Israeli military intelligence. Dominic Suter, the owner of the company and a suspect in the terror attacks, was allowed to flee to Israel after the Federal Bureau of Investigation had initially interviewed him, but before they could interrogate him a second time. He has not been extradited to the United States. After being held for 10 weeks, the five Israelis were sent back to Israel on visa violations. Elner, Marmari, and Shmuel appeared on an Israeli television show without the Kurtzberg brothers in November 2001. The three Israelis confessed that their mission had been to document the 9/11 attacks. Quote, "The fact of the matter is that we come from a country that experiences terror daily, Oded Elner said. Our purpose was to document the event. The Israelis' prior knowledge of the attacks reveals their evident complicity in the murder of some 3,000 people. One would think that such a revealing public admission by a suspect claiming prior knowledge of the terror attack and saying that his purpose was to document the event would be extremely newsworthy information in the United States. Sadly, this was not the case. Rather than discuss the evidence, the mainstream media promoted an unproven version of events in which the blame was assigned to 19 Arabs with ties to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. There were other conspicuous indications of Israeli involvement in 9/11 from the beginning. On the day of the bombings, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli politician from the right-wing Likud party, openly stated that he viewed 9/11 as a positive development in an interview with James Bennett of the New York Times. Quote, "Ask tonight what the attack meant for relations between the United States and Israel." Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister, replied, "It's very good." Then he edited himself, "Well, it's not good, but it will generate immediate sympathy." Netanyahu predicted that the attack would strengthen the bond between our two peoples because we've experienced terror of so many decades, but the United States has now experienced a massive hemorrhaging of terror. The New York Times published Netanyahu's comments in an article entitled, "Spilled Blood is Seen as Bond That Draws Two Nations Closer," on September 12, 2001. Journalists who challenge the official version with evidence and facts are marginalized as conspiracy nuts. I have been slandered by the media simply because I have investigated the evidence of Israeli involvement in the terror attacks. The personal attacks against me led to an assault by three heavily armed, unidentified men who assaulted me at my home in August 2006. The names of these men, who turned out to be undercover police, were kept secret for a month. Their assault left me with a fractured right elbow and shocked with 50,000 volts from a police device known as a taser. This outrageous and illegal assault occurred at my home in front of my wife and 8-year-old daughter. I was taken to jail and subsequently charged with resisting arrest and aggravated assault, both misdemeanor charges. In the Chicago system of justice, one is forced to plead guilty and accept the sentence meted out by the judge. I refused to plead guilty, however, and spent nearly 1 year trying to defend myself against the baseless charges and malicious prosecution. In early June 2007, I was found guilty of both misdemeanors after a seriously flawed 4-day trial in which the police were allowed to destroy the video evidence and then openly lied on the stand. My expert witness and evidence were not allowed to be presented by the Cook County judge, Hyman Riebman, a Zionist Jew. Having seen that there was no way to obtain justice in the corrupt court system, I was compelled to leave Chicago with my family before the date of sentencing. It would have been irresponsible for me to allow this criminal system to harm me and my family more than it already had. The Odigo Warnings. In the first days and weeks after 9/11, I paid very close attention to the large number of Israeli terror suspects arrested, which was more than 200 by November 2001. I also investigated the published reports that an Israeli text messaging service had been used to warn Israelis of the attacks in New York, hours before they occurred. Many Israelis were evidently forewarned of the attacks through an Israeli instant messaging service called Odigo. This story, which presents the clearest evidence of Israeli prior knowledge of the attacks, was reported only very briefly in the U.S. media, and then forgotten. According to the published reports, Israel-based employees of Odigo reported having received warnings of an imminent attack at the World Trade Center hours before the first plane hit the North Tower. Odigo, an Israeli-owned company, had its U.S. headquarters 2 blocks from the World Trade Center, but the forewarned Odigo employees did not pass the terror warning on to the authorities in New York, an act that would have saved thousands of lives. 2 weeks after 9/11, Alex Diamandis, Odigo's vice president, said, "The messages said something big was going to happen in a certain amount of time, and it did, almost to the minute. It was possible that the attack warning was broadcast to other Odigo members, but the company has not received reports of other recipients of the message," Diamandis said. According to a report in the Jerusalem Post, Israel's foreign ministry had collected the names of 4,000 Israelis believed to have been in the areas of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon at the time of the attack, yet only one was reported to have died in the Twin Towers. Based on the number provided by the Israeli government and the number of Israelis thought to have been at the World Trade Center at the time of the attacks, it seems evident that most of them got the warning. Odigo, which offers real-time messaging, has a feature called People Finder, which allows a user to send an instant message to a large group based on a common characteristic, such as Israeli nationality. People Finder allows Odigo users to search for online buddies with filters like Israeli nationality, while maintaining user privacy at all times. The message was probably also sent in Hebrew. The internet address of the sender of the warning was allegedly given to the FBI. 2 months later, it was reported that the FBI was still investigating the matter. Since then, there have been no further media reports about the Odigo warning of 9/11. These two news stories about the fake Israeli movers and the Odigo messages, which clearly indicated that some Israelis had very specific prior knowledge of the attacks, were published in American and Israeli newspapers shortly after 9/11. Had the recipients of these Odigo instant messages contacted the New York Police Department, thousands of lives could have been saved. The question that has not been asked is, why didn't they? Cui bono? There were several early indications that Israelis were involved in 9/11 and that it was a spectacular false flag terror attack designed to serve as a casus belli that could be used to drag the United States into the war on terror. Apart from the previously mentioned evidence of Israeli prior knowledge, there were also the incredibly insensitive comments of Netanyahu about 9/11 being very good in his view. Netanyahu, it should be noted, is the author of several books which call for the Western nations to engage in a global war on terror. Since 1986, Netanyahu has urged the United States and Western democracies to take up arms against the enemies of Israel in the name of fighting terrorism, which is the title of one of his books. The terrorists that Netanyahu wants the West to wage war on, however, all happen to be the people and states opposed to Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian land. I approached the 9/11 investigation with a 25-year history of living in and following the events of the Middle East. After many years of traveling in Europe and the Middle East, I obtained a degree in history from the University of California at Santa Cruz in 1992. My academic emphasis was on Palestine and Israel. After the first U.S. war against Iraq, which I was actively opposed to, I spent my final year of university researching the Soviet occupation of the newly liberated Baltic republics and completing my courses at the University of Bergen in Norway. Fate brought me into the proximity of another mass disaster on the morning of September 28, 1994, when I arrived by ship in Sweden and learned that the Baltic ferry named Estonia had sunk during the night with 852 victims lost at sea. My wife's first husband, a famous Estonian singer named Urmas Alender, was among the missing. While it was abundantly clear that something much more explosive than a monster wave had sunk the ferry, the Swedish government and media pretended that natural forces had caused the catastrophe. In the process of investigating what happened in the ferry disaster, I came to realize that a modern democratic state, like Sweden, could actually be complicit in the cover-up of the mass murder of hundreds of its own citizens. In 2000, when I began working as a journalist for the Washington-based Spotlight, I turned my attention to the mysterious 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800 off the coast of New York. I attended the National Transportation Safety Board's presentation of their findings of what had caused the crash of Flight 800 and was appalled at the obvious cover-up. I noticed how the three Jewish members of the board dominated the presentation. The two-day event ended with the outrageous dismissal of the testimonies of more than 100 eyewitnesses who had testified to having seen a streaking object hitting the aircraft in flight. This eyewitness evidence was categorically dismissed because, according to the youngest member of the board, based solely on the time of day, all of the 100 witnesses must have been drunk and hallucinating. After the presentation of the NTSB findings, there was no press conference or session allowing for any questions from the media or public. This was clearly another cover-up. I had also studied the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty and had seen how the U.S. government and military had covered up the truth of the Israeli military attack on the unarmed Navy vessel off the coast of Egypt in 1967. With this background, I approached the events of 9/11. Well aware of the history of false flag terror, the overwhelming Zionist influence in government and media, and corrupt official investigations of recent mass disasters, I was skeptical from the start. Evidence of explosions ignored. The administration of George W. Bush rushed the nation and its allies into war in Afghanistan within 1 month of the 9/11 attacks, using the unsolved crime as the casus belli to justify a war of aggression that had been planned long before. The war against the government of Afghanistan, called Operation Enduring Freedom by the government and military, began on October 7, 2001. The week before the war began, I wrote an article about the immense oil and gas reserves of the Caspian Basin and the new Great Game to gain control of these valuable energy resources. I also wrote several articles about the long-standing business and personal ties between George W. Bush and the Bin Laden family. 1 month after 9/11, I wrote about how the mass media was ignoring the large number of eyewitness accounts describing explosions at the World Trade Center before the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7. Quote, despite reports from numerous eyewitnesses and experts, including news reporters on the scene who heard or saw explosions immediately before the collapse of the World Trade Center, there has been a virtual silence in the mainstream media, I wrote in the article entitled, Some Survivors Say Bombs Exploded Inside the World Trade Center. After the airplanes hit the World Trade Center, there were some explosive devices inside the buildings that caused the towers to collapse. Van Romero, an explosives expert and former director of the Energetic Materials Research and Testing Center at New Mexico Tech, told the Albuquerque Journal minutes after the collapses. The collapse of the structures resembled controlled implosions used to demolish old structures and was, quote, too methodical to be a chance result of airplanes colliding with the structures, Romero said. Coming from a man who is an expert in the effects of explosives on structures, Romero's comments carried a lot of weight, in my opinion. Quote, it would be difficult for something from a plane to trigger an event like that, Romero said. If explosions did cause the towers to collapse, it could have been a relatively small amount of explosives placed in strategic points. One of the things terrorist events are noted for is a diversionary attack and secondary device, he said. Then, suddenly 10 days after the attack, without any explanation, Romero did a complete about-face in his analysis of the collapse. Quote, "Certainly the fire is what caused the buildings to fail," he told the Albuquerque Journal on September 21, 2001. A friend of mine from Brooklyn told me that he had been standing among a crowd of people on Church Street, about 2 blocks from the South Tower, when he saw, quote, "a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about 6 of these brief flashes, accompanied by a crackling sound, immediately before the tower collapsed." Even a veteran 51-year-old firefighter, Louis Caccioli, told People magazine that he had witnessed explosions in the South Tower. Quote, "I was taking firefighters up in the elevator to the 24th floor to get in position to evacuate workers. On the last trip up, a bomb went off. We think there were bombs set in the building." What is most peculiar about the eyewitness reports of explosions was that they were completely ignored by the mainstream news media, even when the reports came from their own reporters on the scene. Stephen Evans of the BBC, for example, was in the South Tower where he witnessed a series of explosions and felt a big explosion from much, much lower. Yet the BBC, like the rest of the mainstream media, failed to investigate or even discuss the evidence of explosions in the towers. How did the editors of the mass media networks in the United States and Britain make the decision not to discuss the evidence of explosions, even when the information came from their own reporters on the scene? Eyewitness reports and images of explosions were broadcast only once and then swept under the carpet. It soon became quite clear that the mass media was censoring any discussion of the evidence of explosions in the World Trade Center. Within a few weeks, I realized that the media and government were working together to deceive the public about what had really happened on 9/11, and that there was a massive conspiracy afoot to promote a false version of events in order to gain public support for a previously planned war policy in the Middle East. The mass media was clearly engaged in a comprehensive propaganda campaign to instill fear in the public. I decided that Europe would probably be a safer and saner place to be, so at the end of November, after the Thanksgiving holiday, we flew to Germany. The destruction of evidence. In Germany, I had the opportunity to interview Andreas von Bülow in Bonn. Von Bülow is the author of 2 books about 9/11 and a former member of the Bundestag, the German parliament. While in the government, he served on the parliamentary commission which oversees the 3 branches of the German Secret Service. Von Bülow told me that he thought Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad, was behind the 9/11 attacks. These attacks, he said, were carried out to turn public opinion against the Arabs and boost military and security spending. "You don't get the higher echelons," von Bülow said, referring to the architectural structure which masterminds such terror attacks. "At this level," he said, "the organization doing the planning, such as Mossad, is primarily interested in affecting public opinion. The terrorists who actually commit the crimes are what von Bülow calls the working level, such as the 19 Arabs who allegedly hijacked the planes on September 11th. The working level is part of the deception," he said. 95% of the work of the intelligence agencies around the world is deception and disinformation," he said, "which is widely propagated in the mainstream media, creating an accepted version of events. Journalists don't even raise the simplest questions," he said. "Those who differ are labeled as crazy." Eckhard Fertebach, the former president of the Verfassungsschutz, a branch of German intelligence, told me that the deathly precision and the magnitude of planning behind the attacks would have needed years of planning. "Such a sophisticated operation," Fertebach said, "required the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization something not found in a loose group of terrorists. Both Vertebach and von Bülow said the lack of a complete blue ribbon investigation with congressional hearings into the events of September 11th was incomprehensible. These men made more sense to me than anyone in the U.S. government or media. As incomprehensible as it might seem, the Bush administration delayed and avoided an official investigation for as long as possible, at least until all the evidence was destroyed. The steel from the World Trade Center was quickly shipped to Asia, where it was melted down. The evidence from the crime scene was being destroyed as quickly as possible. This was clearly criminal, yet the highest authorities in the U.S. government and the Department of Justice were allowing it to happen. Molten metal. 9/11 is an unsolved crime, and I have done what I can to solve it using the available evidence. In the summer of 2002, for example, I wrote an article about the seismic data that showed unexplained spikes occurring at the beginning of each collapse. In my research into the removal of the rubble, I learned from one of the contractors and a demolition expert that molten metal had been discovered at the bottom of the rubble pile in the lower basement levels. This molten metal was described to me as molten steel by Peter Tully, president of Tully Construction of Flushing, New York, and Mark Loiseau, president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated of Phoenix, Maryland. The molten steel was found 3, 4, and 5 weeks later when the rubble was being removed, Loiseau said. He said molten steel was also found at WTC-7, the 47-story building owned by Larry Silverstein, which collapsed mysteriously in the late afternoon. Loiseau said, "If I were to bring the towers down, I would put explosives in the basement to get the weight of the building to help collapse the structure." The molten metal found beneath the rubble was clearly important evidence that could explain how the towers were brought down. Because each tower was held up by 47 huge core columns, there had to be an explanation for what caused these columns to fall. The official explanation that fires had caused the floor trusses to give way failed to explain what happened to the core columns. To explain the extremely quick collapse of the core columns, the seismic spikes and molten metal seemed to be very important clues. Stephen E. Jones, a professor of physics at Brigham Young University, BYU, in Utah, contacted me in the summer of 2005 and asked me what I had learned about the discovery of molten metal at the World Trade Center. I told Jones exactly what Peter Tully and Mark Loiseau had said about the discovery of molten iron in the basements of the Twin Towers and Building 7. After studying the reports and photographs of molten metal, Jones had been able to obtain some fragments of the metal. He concluded that the fragments were primarily iron and possible evidence that thermite had been used to demolish the buildings. Encouraged by his research, I visited Professor Jones on the campus of Brigham Young University in the spring of 2006. From Provo, Utah, I then traveled by train to the University of California at Davis, where I met with Professor Thomas A. Cahill, an expert on airborne particles. Dr. Cahill had conducted a study of the particles contained in the thin bluish smoke that rose from the rubble for nearly 4 months after 9/11. Cahill's air sampling began on October 2nd and continued until late December 2001, when the last fires were finally extinguished. Asked why it took so long to begin a scientific evaluation of the air contamination that accompanied the destruction of the World Trade Center, Dr. Cahill said he had assumed that there were scores of agencies and scientists monitoring the air quality in New York City after 9/11. "I assumed it was happening. I could not believe it was not," Cahill said. The Environmental Protection Agency did nothing. Cahill's work revealed the presence of extremely small metallic aerosols in unprecedented amounts in the plumes coming from the burning World Trade Center rubble. Most of the particles in these plumes were in the categories of ultrafine and nanoparticles, from 0.26 to 0.09 microns. The extraordinarily high level of ultrafine aerosols was one of the most unusual aspects of the data, Cahill said. Ultrafine particles require extremely high temperatures, he said, namely the boiling point of the metal. Since the scientific data supports the theory that some form of thermite was used to destroy the towers, the question is how it got onto the 81st floor of the South Tower, where large amounts of molten metal were seen falling before the collapse. The official final report of the fires does not explain what was on the 81st floor, which seems odd because this is the floor leased by Fuji Bank into which the airplane crashed. A former employee of the bank came forward and told me that the bank had reinforced the floor in 1999 to support a very heavy load of computer backup batteries. The whole floor was batteries, he said. Huge, battery-looking things. They were all black and solid, very heavy things, which had been brought in during the night. They had been put in place during the summer prior to 9/11, he said. But were they really batteries? It's weird, he said. They were never turned on. So, what really was on the 81st floor of the South Tower? What was in these heavy battery-looking things? Were they batteries or were they thermite? And is it more than a coincidence that both planes flew directly into secure computer rooms in both towers and that both spectacular explosions showed evidence of thermite-produced white smoke? The cover-up continues. Despite the legal difficulties, slander, criticism, and other setbacks, I have continued to examine the evidence from 9/11 and ask the questions that demand to be answered. The lost lives of the thousands of victims of the terror attacks and the illegal wars that have been waged in the name of 9/11 deserve to be honored with the truth, not a pack of lies pushed by the controlled media onto a gullible public. It would be naive and foolish for us to expect the truth from a government that has been shown to have repeatedly lied to the media and international community in order to accomplish its dubious goals. The truth of 9/11 will certainly not be given to us on a silver platter. It is something we will have to fight for. Chapter 2, The Planes of 9/11. Quote, someday, perhaps, if it's decided that the stories can be told, you will see that the state of Israel has been involved in acts which are 1,000 times more dirty than anything going on in Colombia. But these things were decided by the government in cabinet meetings. As long as the government decides to do something, something that the national interest demanded, then it is legitimate. But if an individual wants to do the same thing, it isn't. That's just the way it is. It's very simple. End quote. Lieutenant General Rafael Eitan, Israeli Chief of Staff, 1978 to 1983, from the Columbia Connection, Jerusalem Post, September 1st, 1989. The Planes of 9/11. Unlike those researchers and writers who say they have moved beyond 9/11, I have persevered in my efforts to solve this heinous crime. How can one abandon the pursuit of the truth about 9/11 before the crime has been solved? During the decade after the terrorist attacks in which some 3,000 innocent people died, the federal judge who presided over the 9/11 tort litigation waged a judicial war of attrition against the families of the victims to prevent their cases from ever going to trial. In the end, every one of the 9/11 families was forced into an out-of-court settlement. The 96 families that refused the government compensation money and held out for years to have a trial to find the truth never got their day in court. How can Americans tolerate such injustice? How can we forget the thousands of people who died on 9/11? How can we ignore the death and destruction that has, as a result, been wrongfully inflicted on the innocent people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Palestine? Who can accept corrupt and irresponsible administrations dragging our military from one illegal war to another in the utterly fraudulent War on Terror, which the Bush administration promised will last for generations? If we, as Americans, don't demand the truth about 9/11, who and what do we really stand for? The policies of the Bush and Obama administrations were based on an unproven interpretation of the events of 9/11. What does it mean to be a citizen of the land of the free and the home of the brave if we allow our minds and our nation to be so easily hijacked by government lies and propaganda? After being attacked by undercover police at my home in August 2006 and maliciously prosecuted in a seriously flawed trial, I increased my efforts to solve 9/11. As the cover-up became more obvious and the guilty parties revealed themselves, it made sense to intensify the pressure, not give up. The fraudulent war on terror. I cannot accept mass murder, occupation, and genocidal wars of aggression. Nor can I accept the corruption of our values and destruction of our basic American rights to facilitate the massive fraud known as the War on Terror. With the passage of time, it has become quite clear that 9/11 was carried out to kickstart the global War on Terror with its pre-planned wars of aggression. In December 2001, veteran German intelligence professionals told me that 9/11 had been executed by a state-sponsored criminal network and had required years of planning. Eckhard Wertebach, the former president of Germany's domestic intelligence service, the Verfassungsschutz, told me in 2001 that the deathly precision and the magnitude of planning of the 9/11 attacks would have required years of planning. Such a sophisticated operation, Wertebach said, would require the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization, something not found in a loose group like the one allegedly led by Mohammed Atta while he studied in Hamburg. If Wertebach's analysis is correct, and I have every reason to believe it is, the official version is nothing but a pack of lies. This would mean that the members of the criminal network are still occupying the highest positions of power in the United States, Israel, and other nations. The members of this network are dedicated to preventing the evidence from being released because it would expose the real perpetrators. This is the only logical reason why the 9/11 evidence has been suppressed, the investigation controlled, and the litigation and discovery processes obstructed. At this point, it should be clear that 9/11 will never be solved by the federal government, politically appointed investigators, law enforcement agencies, or the corrupt courts. These controlled agencies, like the Zionist-controlled media, are only interested in controlling the information and preventing the real truth from being revealed. This crime will only be solved by concerned and dedicated independent researchers. The Zionist strategy. 9/11 was a very sophisticated operation, as Wertebach said, which required the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization. It was carefully planned years in advance and carried out for one strategic purpose, to kickstart the Zionist-planned war on terror. The rabid Zionist neocons who dominated the Bush administration pushed the war on terror with its criminal wars of aggression, occupation, and balkanization in the Middle East as the strategic response to 9/11. Likewise, the Zionist media moguls, who dominate the U.S. mass media, promoted the war on terror as the suitable and proper response to the terror atrocity, a crime of mass murder which they refused to investigate. An Israeli official named Oded Yinon revealed the Zionist strategy to balkanize the entire Middle East into ethnic mini-states in the early 1980s. The plan for a global war on terror to accomplish this goal has been articulated since the mid-1980s by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister of the extreme right-wing Likud Party. The Israeli military's plans to realize these strategic goals were evidently in the works for at least 20 years before 9/11. The hoax of 9/11. 9/11 is, in fact, a gigantic hoax. Only by exposing the terrorist masterminds behind 9/11 will we reveal the criminals behind the fraudulent war on terror and the epidemic of false flag terrorism that plagues the world. False flag terrorism is a crime designed and committed with the intention that the blame will fall on a targeted faction, state, or organization. The media outlets, which the criminals control, facilitate the blame game by promoting the false version and stifling any independent investigation or truthful analysis of the crime. After all, 9/11 remains an unsolved crime. It is, however, rather obvious who is responsible for blocking discovery and obstructing justice for the victims and their relatives. At every critical point where the events and circumstances of 9/11 should have been investigated and discussed, there has been a Zionist, a dedicated devotee of the State of Israel, occupying a key position and acting as the controller and censor of evidence, the gatekeeper of information. I have seen this pattern in earlier cover-ups. The same pattern was used with the sinking of Estonia in the Baltic Sea in 1994, and the U.S. government's NTSB investigation of the downing of TWA Flight 800, two of the most egregious examples of government cover-ups in modern times. In each case, the three critical phases of the cover-up, investigation and access to the evidence, media interpretation of the event, and related litigation were all tightly controlled to prevent any meaningful discovery of what had really caused the disaster. The people who are preventing the discovery of the facts in such cases are actually complicit in covering up crimes of mass murder. Logically, there can be no reason for dedicated Zionists to obstruct the investigation of 9/11 other than to conceal the evidence of Israeli and Zionist involvement in the crimes. The FBI, for example, under the command of the Israeli dual national Michael Chertoff, was responsible for the confiscation and destruction of the crucial evidence from 9/11. Chertoff, as Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, oversaw the non-investigation of 9/11, which resulted in the massive destruction of the steel, crucial evidence from the World Trade Center. Chertoff went on to head the Department of Homeland Security, where he continued to control access to the evidence through the Sensitive Security Information, SSI, program. The confiscated evidence includes videotapes of the Pentagon attack and physical pieces from what different aircraft were involved. This evidence is critical to prove what happened and identify the aircraft involved in the attacks, but the FBI has refused to release this evidence. Neither President George W. Bush nor the U.S. Congress demanded that they do so. Under President Barack Obama, the 9/11 cover-up was perpetuated and the war effort in Afghanistan increased. The destruction of the crucial evidence from 9/11 and the lack of a real investigation reveal the culture of corruption that prevails in Washington. The appointed federal judges, Alvin K. Hellerstein and Michael B. Mukasey, and the former Assistant Attorney General Michael Chertoff, did not confiscate and destroy the critical evidence and block discovery in order to protect fanatical Arab Muslims or conspiratorial Jesuits. These men are all dedicated Zionists, and their efforts were exerted to protect Israel, the foreign state to which they are wholeheartedly devoted. U.S. District Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein managed the 9/11 tort litigation, in which not one single wrongful death case went to trial. Judge Hellerstein has close family ties to Israel and the Israeli airport security company, ICTS, a key defendant in the tort litigation. The Zionist role in 9/11 cover-up is obvious. The players who are involved in obstructing justice are known. Patriotic Americans must not abandon the pursuit of the truth. For those who died on 9/11, for our nation and our posterity, we are obliged to find and expose those who are responsible for the crimes and cover-up of 9/11. The evidence of Israeli involvement. I have pursued the leads of Israeli involvement simply because the evidence indicates that the Israeli military and intelligence had prior knowledge and involvement in 9/11. The five jubilant Israeli Mossad agents who were caught celebrating and filming themselves in front of the destruction of the World Trade Center and their subsequent public statements clearly indicate that the Mossad had prior knowledge of 9/11. The text message warnings of the attacks sent over the Israeli-owned Odigo instant messaging system several hours prior to the attacks are further evidence of Israeli prior knowledge. Furthermore, the Israelis have a long history of committing false flag terror attacks, particularly against American targets. The Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in 1967 and the Israeli terrorist bombings of U.S. and British civilian targets in Egypt during the 1954 Levon Affair are the first that come to mind. If the evidence indicated that Saudis, Pakistanis, or even Jesuits were behind the attacks, I would investigate them. The evidence, however, points to Israelis being involved, so I look there. There has been no independent investigation of 9/11 done by the controlled media, other than Carl Cameron's now deeply buried four-part series on Fox News in December 2001. Think about this for a minute. The mass media in the land of the free press has not done any independent investigation about the crime of the century. The evidence of Israeli involvement in 9/11 is so obvious that senior editors in the controlled media don't even let their journalists approach the subject. The journalists of the free press in the United States are confined to the same Auschwitz of the mind as the American public they write for. This is a self-imposed limit on what they allow themselves to think or express, in particular about Israel, because of the Jewish suffering of World War II. Journalists know very well that to touch the subject of Israeli involvement in 9/11 would be like touching a live wire. Likewise, when it comes to tracking the Israeli criminal network that has operated in the United States for decades, the U.S. media is a dog that won't bark or hunt. The extent of Zionist control over the U.S. mass media, including the Internet, is astounding. The mass media has effectively prevented most Americans from understanding who is really behind the false flag terror attacks of 9/11, and by extension, the illegal and genocidal wars in Afghanistan, Palestine, Lebanon, and Iraq. The controlled media has also left Americans with an extremely distorted view of the Middle East, Zionism, and the history of the Zionist state, Israel. Israel, a terrorist state. Israel is a nation that was founded by terrorists, ruthless men with histories of committing genocidal crimes and false flag terror attacks. Israel was created in 1948 in Palestine, on land that was ethnically cleansed of its indigenous Christian and Muslim inhabitants. Ariel Sharon, the former prime minister who has been in a coma since January 4, 2006, is a prime example of an Israeli terrorist. Sharon came to power in early 2001, about the same time as George W. Bush, some 8 months before 9/11. Sharon is a well-known terrorist and genocidaire. That is a person who has been involved in genocide. Sharon has supervised numerous terrorist atrocities, such as the 1982 massacre in Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, in which thousands of innocent people were massacred. Sharon is a Zionist extremist who believes that every Jew should live in Israeli-occupied Palestine. Realistically, what else besides terrorism and bloodshed should one expect from such fanatical and genocidal terrorists? The sons and daughters of the original Zionist terrorists have occupied the highest positions of power in the Israeli government. Tzipora Malka, Tzipi Livni, for example, the foreign minister from 2006 to 2009, is the daughter of the former terror chief of the Irgun. Born in Tel Aviv in July 1958, Tzipi is the daughter of Eitan Livni, born Yerucham Bzozovich in Grodno, 1919. A Polish-born Irgun terrorist associated with the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. Stephen Erlanger of the New York Times wrote an article about Livni entitled Israel's Top Envoy on February 5, 2006. Quote, Tzipi Livni, 47, is the first woman to serve as Israel's foreign minister since Golda Meir. Some think she may be the first since Mrs. Meir to be prime minister. She is also a deeply Israeli figure, the daughter of Zionist guerrillas, terrorists in some eyes, who met in the Irgun, the underground organization that fought the British and the Arabs, and that blew up the British headquarters in the King David Hotel in 1946, killing 91 people. End quote. Her father, Eitan Livni, was the head of operations for the Irgun terrorists, and on his gravestone is the map of Greater Israel, extending over both sides of the Jordan River. Erlanger suggests that blowing up a hotel and killing 91 people is only seen as a terrorist act in some eyes. Israeli false flag terrorism. The fact that the Israeli political leadership and military command decided to launch a vicious attack on a defenseless U.S. reconnaissance ship, the USS Liberty, off the coast of Gaza in June 1967, and kill every man on board, illustrates that the Israelis are fully capable of committing such atrocities in their attempts to blame their enemies and achieve their strategic goals. Dedicated Zionists will defend these acts of Israeli false flag terrorism as the pragmatic thing to do, and attack those who disagree as being anti-Semitic. The Zionist-controlled media adamantly refused to conduct its own investigation of 9/11, the seminal event of the war on terror. Controlled news outlets, like the New York Times, promoted the pre-planned wars of aggression against Afghanistan and Iraq with propaganda pieces and false reports about weapons of mass destruction, such as those provided by Judith Miller. Miller is the daughter of William Miller, a Jewish immigrant from Pinsk, Russia, who started out at a New Jersey nightclub and made it big as entertainment director of the Sahara, Dunes, Flamingo, and International Hotels in Las Vegas. False flag terror attacks are an Israeli specialty, as Dr. Qasem Khalil points out in his book, Wrongly Blamed, 2007. Quote, public terror was invented by the Israelis, Khalil wrote, citing Christopher Sykes' book, Crossroads to Israel. Quote, to achieve their political goals, Zionists are dependent on terror. These terror acts are used as a distraction. Even though the Israelis are the sources, they effectively blame others. The fabricated terror they commit is an assault on people's intelligence. Thus, people are being purposely misled regarding the real source of these crimes. End quote. The Zionist-controlled media has purposely misled the public about 9/11 for the same reason as the Zionist judges, investigators, and commissioners, to protect the evidence of Israeli involvement from being exposed. The controlled U.S. media works with the Zionist criminal network and allows it to flourish by failing to investigate and identify the companies and individuals involved. The planes of 9/11. 9/11 was an act of false flag terror in which four allegedly hijacked airplanes were used as weapons of mass destruction. There are, however, many unanswered questions about the airplanes involved. There are many observations about these planes which suggest they were not the civilian airliners they are said to have been. The plane that struck the South Tower, for example, had unusual shapes, bulges, and holes, which have led many analysts to believe it was a Boeing 767-300 refueling tanker that had been disguised as a 767-200 United Airlines passenger jet. Durable parts from the two jets that struck the Twin Towers, such as landing gear and engines, landed on buildings and streets of Manhattan. On these engines and landing gear are many numbered time-tracked parts, which could prove precisely which aircraft they had been put on and when they had been serviced. But the FBI has refused to present this evidence to make its case. Why wouldn't the FBI present this evidence if it had it? The only possible explanation for the FBI's failure to present this evidence is that it does not match the planes they claim hit the buildings or crashed in Pennsylvania. If the planes that were involved in the attacks on the World Trade Center were, in fact, not United Airlines Flight 175 and American Airlines Flight 11, but remotely controlled tankers painted to look like civilian aircraft, who could have produced such disguised planes and inserted them into the NORAD anti-terrorism exercise that was taking place in the airspace of the East Coast on the morning of 9/11? Israel Aircraft Industries. Given the evidence of Israeli prior knowledge, some obvious questions arise. Did the Israelis have the capability to carry off such a complex operation? If they did, is there a link between their capability and the events of 9/11? The answer to both questions is yes. The Israeli military and its intelligence agencies have long had the capability to convert and disguise large body aircraft in the United States, and their companies that do this kind of work are connected to International Consultants on Targeted Security, ICTS. ICTS is the Israeli airport security company based in the Netherlands that is a prime suspect in the false flag terrorism of 9/11. ICTS was a key defendant in the 9/11 tort litigation until Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein dismissed the Mossad-linked company from the case in May 2011. The Israeli military has spawned several aircraft leasing and maintenance companies in the United States since the late 1960s. There is, in fact, a network of Israeli-controlled aviation companies operating in the United States, which were all started by Israel Aircraft Industries, now known as Israel Aerospace Industries. IAI is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Israeli Defense Ministry, which produces and maintains planes and missiles. One of the Israeli military aviation companies spawned in the United States was an aircraft leasing company named Atasco, which began operating in the United States in the early 1970s. I began investigating Atasco in August 2006. As a matter of fact, I had spoken with Shalom Yoran, the Israeli chairman of this now defunct Israeli company, about 6 hours before a squad of three undercover police arrived at my house and, without cause or provocation, tackled me on my front lawn. While I was pinned down beneath two men, one kneeling on the temple of my head, they applied a taser directly to my back and gave me a shock of 50,000 volts. The police assault at my home on August 15, 2006, left me with a fractured elbow. I had come across Shalom Yoran's name while researching Amit and Naftali Yoran, the suspicious young Israelis who oversaw cybersecurity for the U.S. government and military computers prior to and after 9/11. Shalom Yoran has an extremely suspicious and unusual profile for an Israeli immigrant to the United States. He was in the original Israeli Air Force of 1948 and is a founder and former head of Israel Aircraft Industries. Yaron was instrumental in building the IAI into an internationally recognized company and the largest industry in Israel. Before Yaron emigrated to the United States, which is very unusual for Israelis of his age and with his high-level military background, he had spent the previous 10 years as senior vice president of IAI and as president of IAI's parent company, BEDEC. Israelis like Yaron don't usually come to America as immigrants. They are sent there on a mission. Israel Aircraft Industries was established in 1953 as BEDEC Aviation Company, 5 years after the establishment of the State of Israel. Today, BEDEC is the senior group of Israel Aerospace Industries and specializes in aircraft operation, conversion, maintenance, and overhaul. In 1975, when Yaron left BEDEC and IAI at the unusually young retirement age of 50, the corporation had 22,000 employees, of which 4,000 worked in the BEDEC division. In reality, Yaron didn't leave BEDEC and IAI at all. He was sent by the Israeli military to the United States to manage one of their most important operations, Atasco. In his online biographies, Yaron says that he was appointed to this position. Quote, when he retired at the age of 50, he was appointed the president of Atasco, an American flight company for cargo shipment and maintenance. His 2003 biography on the website of Tel Aviv University has a similar tale. Quote, at the age of 50, Shalom Yaron retired from the Israel Aircraft Industries. In 1978, he moved to the United States, where he became chairman of Atasco USA, a private aircraft trading and service company. Atasco bought and leased airplanes to major airlines around the world. The company also had an aircraft maintenance and modification plant in Smyrna, Tennessee. Quote, Shalom Yaron continues to be chairman of Atasco USA, the 2003 Tel Aviv University entry noted. How could an Israeli be appointed to be president or chairman of an American company unless that company were actually an Israeli company disguised as an American company? And why would an Israeli company doing business in the United States want to disguise the fact that it is Israeli owned in the first place? The Atasco-BEDEC connection. Atasco USA was, of course, created and owned by the Israeli military and connected to the Mossad, but this information is not easily found. There has only been one article that I have found that mentions what Atasco has been doing for the past 36 years in the United States, since it was first created by the Israeli Defense Ministry in 1971. That article, entitled Ugandan Plane Deal Believed Key to Israeli Spy Operation, was published in the Washington Post of September 11, 1978. This investigative article, which involved an international team of journalists that included an Israeli, focused on the mysterious Israeli tycoon and the Mossad, Israel's intelligence service, and how they had provided the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin with two Boeing 707 jetliners as part of an Israeli effort to spy on Libya. The big winner and tycoon in this Mossad spying operation was Shaul Nehemiah Eisenberg, 1921 to 1997, the reclusive Israeli entrepreneur at its center. Eisenberg was, as the Washington Post reported in 1978, the central figure in the Mossad spying operation on Libya. Quote, the chief Eisenberg firm in these deals was Aircraft Trading and Services Incorporated, or Atasco. Headquartered in Asia House, Eisenberg's luxury building in Tel Aviv, Atasco also has branches in the Eisenberg building in New York and in London. Atasco was put together in 1971 by executives of Israeli Aircraft Industries, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Israeli Defense Ministry that makes planes and missiles. Eisenberg got into Atasco as an equal partner with Israeli aircraft for $500,000 in cash. After the 1973 Middle East War, Israeli aircraft, staggered by scandals, sold its share in Atasco to Eisenberg, leaving him its sole owner. The rest of Atasco's original capital, $5 million, came from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which is supposed to make loans to promote American exports. The Export-Import Bank certainly found the right man in Eisenberg. He quickly turned into an eager customer for Pan American Airways' used Boeing 707s. Atasco bought 12 or 15 of the advanced series 707s that Pan Am was selling and purchased 6 out of 10 earlier Series C 707s being sold by the airline. At its Israeli hangars, currently jammed with 707s bearing obscure markings, Atasco remodels the interiors to suit customers and paints on their proud colors, Iran Air, Tarom of Romania, Uganda Airlines. In May 1976, Atasco sold the 707 that was once Pan Am's Clipper Jupiter to a firm in Zurich, which dealt it on to Amin. Intelligence sources say that the head of this Zurich firm is a 15-year veteran of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and the firm is an agency laundry. It exists, these sources say, to pass on Mossad funds for deals in which the Israeli Secret Service is interested. End quote. The Washington Post, one of the most important newspapers in the United States, is a leading national newspaper of record. Oddly, however, the extremely important information contained in this article about Atasco was never repeated in any of the subsequent articles in which this mysterious company was mentioned. For example, when Gerald L. Gittner, an aviation executive with Pan Am, TWA, and a host of smaller airlines, was appointed chief executive officer of Atasco USA. In 1986, when Gittner became CEO of the Israeli-owned company with a documented history of murky business, the company was described as a New York aircraft leasing and brokerage company. Atasco's previously published history of involvement in Mossad operations was never mentioned. Gittner, who was CEO of Mossad's privately held aircraft leasing and maintenance company until 1990, was involved in the dismemberment and selling off of the assets of the once prosperous Pan Am and TWA airlines. In October 1986, when Gittner was appointed CEO of the Mossad-run Atasco USA Incorporated, he was or had been a senior executive with Pan Am Corporation and TWA. He was the president of Texas Air Corporation, the holding company for Continental Airlines and New York Air, when he was appointed president and CEO of Atasco USA, a private aviation concern involved in commercial aircraft leasing and heavy aircraft maintenance. Gittner was also co-founder and president of People Express Airlines. The Houston Chronicle of October 3, 1986, however, only identified Atasco as, quote, an aircraft leasing and brokerage company. Shaul Eisenberg, world entrepreneur. In November 1982, when Eisenberg became involved in the Tregaron deal and tried to take over a large piece of prime real estate in Washington, D.C., the Washington Post wrote about Mossad's world entrepreneur and their point man in China and Panama. Quote, Eisenberg was profiled in a 1981 Business Week article as a businessman of enormous wealth, diversity of business interests, and a proclivity for secretiveness in his dealings. He owns a worldwide network of corporations. His largest company, United Development Incorporated, was set up in Panama in 1960. Eisenberg essentially acts as a middleman, according to reports on his dealings, assembling consortiums of manufacturers, builders, and banks to construct industrial facilities of all types. End quote. Since Eisenberg was the sole owner of Atasco since 1973, The Mossad's aircraft trading and services company naturally began its murky business on the American continent in Panama. In 1978, the Washington Post reported that there were frequent but unsubstantiated reports that Eisenberg operates mostly from Central America. Eisenberg was also the Panamanian honorary general counsel in Tel Aviv, the Post reported. The first mention of Atasco, other than the 1978 article in the Washington Post, was in the New York Times on October 29, 1981, when it reported that Emery Air Freight had purchased a Boeing 727-100 from Atasco, Panama. IDF, Israeli Drug Forces. Israel Aircraft Industries also has a branch, IAI, Sucursal, Colombia, in Bogota, Colombia. Colombia is a nation better known for the production and distribution of cocaine than aircraft. Why would IAI establish aircraft leasing and maintenance facilities in Colombia and Panama? Is airlifting drugs a central part of the IAI operations in Latin America? Does the Mossad use IAI facilities in Colombia to run its own drug smuggling routes to fund its operations? Does Mossad drug smuggling involve American politicians and intelligence agencies, which it controls through criminal complicity? There are a number of indications that the Mossad is deeply involved in the Colombian drug trade. A horde of Mossad operatives, disguised as Israeli art students, were targeting the offices and personnel of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, for 2 years prior to 9/11. Why would the Mossad be seeking to penetrate the DEA if it were not involved in drug smuggling? It is well known that Israeli criminal gangs are heavily involved in illicit drug smuggling. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz, for example, reported in 2003 that Israel is at the center of the international trade in the drug ecstasy, according to a document published by the U.S. State Department. Quote, "In recent years, organized crime in Israel, some with links to criminal organizations in Russia, have come to control the distribution of the drug in Europe, according to a Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs document," Haaretz reported. Quote, "During 2000, 80% of the ecstasy seized in North America originated in the Netherlands, which is the largest production center, along with Belgium and Poland. The State Department is certain that Israeli organizations are linked to the laboratories in the Netherlands and are responsible for the worldwide distribution. Israeli drug distribution organizations are currently the main source for distribution of the drug to groups inside the United States, to smuggling through express mail services, through couriers on commercial flights, and recently through air cargo," the report stated. It should be noted that the Israeli airport security firm ICTS handles airport security at Schiphol, the international airport of Amsterdam. Why is the Mossad-linked airport security company based in Holland? The rumors about the Bush and Clinton families being involved in large-scale drug smuggling operations are legendary. From George Herbert Walker Bush's days in the Texas oil business and as head of the CIA to his position as a director of the Prozac giant Eli Lilly and Company, the drug trade is a central part of the Bush family business. The allegations about Governor Bill Clinton's involvement in the drug smuggling operation in Mena, Arkansas, are equally legendary. Aircraft were used to smuggle drugs and weapons through the airport in Mena in the 1980s, while Clinton protected the entire operation. Quote, "Given the scope and implications of the Mena story, it may be easy to understand the media's initial skepticism and reluctance," Sally Denton and Roger Morris wrote in their July 1995 article, "The Crimes of Mena." Quote, "Mena, from 1981 to 1985, was indeed one of the centers for international smuggling traffic, according to official IRS and DEA calculations, sworn court testimony, and other corroborative records, the traffic amounted to thousands of kilos of cocaine and heroin, and literally hundreds of millions of dollars in drug profits. According to a 1986 letter from the Louisiana Attorney General to then U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese, Adler, Berryman, Seal, or Barry Seal, smuggled between $3 billion and $5 billion worth of drugs into the United States. End quote. Adler Berryman Seal had been a pilot with TWA from 1966 to 1974, according to his online biography. Gittner, who began his career at TWA in 1968, was a vice president when he also left TWA in 1974 to join the much smaller Texas International Airlines. The numerous reports and allegations of involvement in drug smuggling are what the Bush and Clinton families have in common. These are the families which have dominated the executive branch of the United States government since 1981. There was either a Bush or Clinton in the White House from January 1981 until January 2009. Is the illegal drug business the central criminal activity that the Bush and Clinton families have participated in with the Israeli Mossad? If the reports, allegations, and rumors are true, the illegal drug trade is where the interests of the Bush family, the Clintons, the CIA, and the Mossad all come together. This would explain the choice to invade and occupy Afghanistan, where opium production is now at record levels after having been nearly eradicated under the Taliban regime. This would also explain the unusual pressure to medicate the 9/11 relatives with mind-altering drugs like Prozac. It appears that drug smuggling could very well be the illegal enterprise at the center of the criminal network behind 9/11. This is a subject that deserves further investigation. Clipper Jupiter and Zemex Aviation. In the 1978 article about Eisenberg and the Mossad, the Washington Post reported that Atasco had sold the Boeing 707, which had been Pan Am's Clipper Jupiter, to a firm in Zurich, which had immediately transferred ownership to Idi Amin in Uganda. Quote, intelligence sources say that the head of this Zurich firm is a 15-year veteran of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and the firm is an agency laundry. It exists, these sources say, to pass on Mossad funds for deals in which the Israeli Secret Service is interested. Pan Am's Clipper Jupiter, with tailed registration number N766PA, was sold to a Zurich-based company called Zemex Aviation on May 12, 1976. The same day, Zemex Aviation transferred the plane with a new tail number, 5XUAL, to Uganda Airlines. End quote. The 15-year veteran of Mossad would be Hans Ziegler, who headed Zemex, as reported in the Oregonian, on August 22, 1988. Quote, Charles Hanner, then a Page Airways vice president, testified by deposition that he had been introduced to Amin by Hans Ziegler, a veteran agent of Mossad, the Israeli Military Intelligence Service. Ziegler's Swiss company, Zemex Aviation, had sold a number of aircraft to Middle Eastern potentates and to Amin's friend Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan dictator. End quote. Atasco ties to 9/11. Gittner reportedly stayed with Atasco from October 1986 through December 1989. In 1989, Gittner was appointed to head Presidential Airways of Herndon, Virginia. Gittner later served on the board of directors of another Mossad-run company, ICTS, one of the key defendants in the 9/11 tort litigation. Along with a handful of senior Israeli Mossad veterans, Gittner was a director of ICTS from at least 1997 through 2005. ICTS was responsible for airline security and passenger screening at Boston's Logan Airport on 9/11. International Consultants on Targeted Security, ICTS, is the Mossad-linked company that owns Huntley USA, the airline security company that oversaw the passenger screening operations at Boston's Logan Airport on September 11, 2001. How would Gittner be a director or CEO of a Mossad-run company like Itasco or ICTS if he were not working for the Mossad? Has Gerald Gittner from Boston been working with the Israelis since he began at TWA in the late 1960s? Is this the reason he left TWA and began working for Texas International? BedEx specialty, Boeing 767 conversions. IAI is a world leader in aircraft conversion and modernization programs, unmanned air vehicles, UAVs, communication programs, and defense electronics, according to the company's website. Shalom Yuran's company, BedEx Aviation Group, reportedly converted its first Boeing 767 from a passenger to cargo jet in early 2000. The converted passenger jet was the first of 11 767s to be converted for Airborne Express, according to the Jerusalem Post of April 4, 2000. BedEx is one of the world's leaders in plane conversions, the Israeli newspaper reported. In early 2001, BedEx delivered a refurbished Boeing 707 refueling tanker for the Israeli Air Force, according to the Jerusalem Post of February 22, 2001. The number of Israeli refueling tankers is classified, the Post reported. The first 707 air refueling tanker converted for the Air Force was delivered 20 years ago. This Israeli report indicates that BedEx has been converting Boeing aircraft into tankers since the early 1980s. The main benefit of this present aircraft is in its versatility, its quick conversion from a refueling tanker to a cargo jet. In this way, the aircraft can be used as a cargo plane in times of peace and a refueling tanker in an emergency, the IAI statement said. IAI in Miami, Commodore Aviation. Boeing has been working with Israel Aircraft Industries Limited for 30 years, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer reported in October 1998. Miami International Airport has long been the site of one of BedEx's maintenance stations, along with Paris, Moscow, Baku, and Baikal, according to the Jerusalem Post of January 13, 1995. The BedEx operation in Miami was known as Commodore Aviation. IAI and BedEx had offices in Arlington, Virginia, New York City, Princeton, New Jersey, for its Galaxy Aerospace subsidiary, and in Miami for its Commodore Aviation unit, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer article from 1998. Florida Governor Jeb Bush made a four-day trade mission visit to Israel in November 1999, during which he appealed to the state-owned Israel Aircraft Industries to expand their business operations in Florida. IAI's Miami-based Commodore Aviation was already the largest Israeli business presence in Florida in 1999, with about 500 employees, the Stewart News reported. In 2003, Commodore Aviation, part of IAI's BedEx Aviation Group, pulled out of Miami, reportedly owing nearly $1 million to the Miami airport, and moved to Rome, New York, where it renamed its operations the Empire Air Center. Commodore has been searching for a new location since June 2002 and owes $800,000 in back rent to Miami International Airport, where it's currently based, South Florida CEO reported in May 2003, when it announced Commodore Aviation's move to New York and its name change. Like Itasco, Commodore has been generously funded by the U.S. taxpayer. Commodore Aviation actually made money by its move to the former Griffiths Air Force Base, where it operates in a massive hangar in which B-52 bombers and tankers were once serviced. The move profited Commodore, which received some $25 million in grants and tax incentives from federal and New York government sources, the Jerusalem Post reported on November 21, 2003. The whole relocation didn't cost IAI $1, said Jerry Stoke, New York State Economic Attaché in Israel. Chapter 3, America the Target, 9/11 and Israel's History of False Flag Terrorism. Quote, I sat with former Mossad chief Yisr Harel for a conversation about Arab terrorism. As he handed me a cup of hot tea and a plate of cookies, I asked him, do you think terrorism will come to America? And if so, where and why? Harel looked at his American visitor and replied, I fear it will come to you in America. America has the power, but not the will, to fight terrorism. The terrorists have the will, but not the power, to fight America. But all that could change with time. Arab oil money buys more than tents. As to the where, Harel continued, New York City is the symbol of freedom and capitalism. It's likely they will strike the Empire State Building, your tallest building, he mistakenly thought, and a symbol of your power. 21 years later, the first part of Harel's prediction came true, except, of course, that the twin towers of the World Trade Center were much taller than the Empire State Building. Close quote. Michael D. Evans on what Israeli intelligence chief Yisr Harel told him in September 1980. America the Target. Jerusalem Post, September 30th, 2001. America the Target, 9/11 and Israel's History of False Flag Terrorism. The Israeli military has a history of owning and operating private aircraft leasing and maintenance companies in the United States. These privately held aviation companies, created by the Israeli military and linked to its state-owned aviation industry, had the capability and advanced avionics required to convert Boeing aircraft into remote-controlled drones like those that evidently struck the World Trade Center on 9/11. Given the Israeli military's capability to carry out the attacks, the evidence of Israeli prior knowledge raises a fundamental question that must be asked. Would the Israeli military conduct such an outrageous act of terror? Millions of Americans have blindly accepted, without any proof, the government and controlled media's fictitious tale that 19 Arabs who lacked basic piloting skills were responsible for the coordinated precision aerial attacks and subsequent carnage and destruction of 9/11. On the other hand, the same government and media have shown absolutely no interest in probing the evidence or looking into the many unanswered questions surrounding the attacks. There can only be one logical explanation for such persistent avoidance of the evidence by the people who should be leading the investigation. They have avoided the evidence because it contradicts the fiction they have presented to the public. The number of people who realize that the government and media have lied about 9/11 is significant and continues to grow all the time. The pack of lies surrounding the attacks has been thoroughly exposed and can no longer be supported. Unable to defend their fiction in the face of facts and evidence presented by honest scientists and writers, the defenders of the 9/11 lie use disinformation, defamation, and slander to try and prevent the truth from spreading like wildfire. Israeli prior knowledge. While the evidence indicates that the Israelis had prior knowledge of 9/11, commonly held misconceptions about Israel and a general lack of understanding of Zionism's brutal history of terrorism prevent most people from comprehending the Israeli connection. The ignorance of Zionist history, cultivated by the controlled media, prevents people from understanding reality in the Middle East. It is essential to have a grasp of the history of previous Israeli attacks on the United States to understand 9/11. This chapter examines a few little-known but key events in the history of Israeli false flag terror attacks and the people behind them. The names and events discussed in this chapter are at the center of Zionist terrorism, false flag, and otherwise. False flag terrorism means an act of terror planned and perpetrated by one party for the purpose of having the blame assigned to its enemy for political or strategic purposes. False flag attacks are designed to foment hostility or instigate war between groups or nations. 9/11, like many of the terror attacks that have occurred in occupied Iraq, was a textbook false flag operation. Very rarely has the United States, oceans away from the conflicts of Europe and Asia, actually been attacked by foreign militaries. The British invasion during the War of 1812 and the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941 are the only foreign attacks prior to 9/11 that come to mind. Although 9/11 is disguised and interpreted by the government and media as an act of terrorism carried out by Islamic fanatics, the evidence indicates that it was a carefully planned false flag attack carried out by the Israeli military after years of planning and preparation. Evidence of Israeli involvement. This is not a hypothesis that can be easily dismissed as based on speculation or prejudice. There is solid evidence that Israeli intelligence agencies had prior knowledge of 9/11, which is indicative of involvement in the attacks. Public statements made by key terror suspects, the five jubilant movers arrested in New Jersey, for example, who were actually Israeli intelligence agents, indicate that they possessed prior knowledge of the attacks. In November 2001, after 2 months in U.S. custody, three of the five agents appeared on Israeli television and admitted, in plain Hebrew, that their purpose had been to document the event. The Israeli interviewer did not ask who had sent them, but it is quite clear they were working for Israeli intelligence. The five fake movers from Urban Moving Systems of Weehawken, New Jersey, were actually operatives of the Israeli Secret Service. The five Israeli agents, described in early news reports as Middle Eastern, had been sought by the FBI and New Jersey authorities after they had been seen celebrating and photographing the destruction of the World Trade Center. The Israelis made a video of themselves with the burning towers behind them as they flicked their cigarette lighters, laughed, and celebrated as hundreds of innocent people were being roasted alive. Reportedly, they had worn Palestinian or Arab garb, which was later found in their van. The Israeli agents, who were caught with multiple passports, box cutters, and thousands of dollars stuffed into their socks, were driving a van that tested positive for explosives when they were arrested. Two of the five were actually on a list of foreign intelligence agents known to U.S. law enforcement authorities at the time. ABC News did a follow-up on the Israeli agents in June 2002. Quote, "The arresting officers said they saw a lot that aroused their suspicion about the men. One of the passengers had $4,700 in cash hidden in his sock. Another was carrying two foreign passports. A box cutter was found in the van. But perhaps the biggest surprise for the officers came when the five men identified themselves as Israeli citizens. We are not your problem. According to the police report, one of the passengers told the officers they had been on the West Side Highway in Manhattan during the incident, referring to the World Trade Center attack. The driver of the van, Sivan Kurtzberg, told the officers, 'We are Israeli. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are the problem.' The other passengers were his brother Paul Kurtzberg, Yaron Shmuel, Oded Elner, and Omer Marmari." Close quote. The five movers were evidently part of a much larger Israeli operation in New York City. The Urban Moving Systems Company was later exposed as a Mossad front company, a fake agency set up to facilitate the terror operation. An American who worked with the company said he was shocked to see that the Israeli employees had openly rejoiced over the attacks. In November 2001, the five Israeli terror suspects were returned to Israel on visa violations, although they had repeatedly refused to take, and then failed, lie detector tests concerning their involvement in 9/11. Instant messages warning of the attack at the World Trade Center and predicting the bombing to the precise minute were sent via the Mossad-owned Odigo messaging system hours before the first plane hit the North Tower. These warnings are further evidence that Israeli intelligence had very specific and accurate knowledge of the terror attacks long before they occurred. In a complex and elaborately planned crime of mass murder and terrorism, like 9/11, possession of specific prior knowledge, like that held by the fake Israeli movers and the senders of the Odigo messages, is evidence of complicity in the crime. Had the recipients of the Odigo warnings contacted the authorities in New York City, thousands of lives would have been saved. If these people were not complicit in the crime, why didn't they contact the authorities? Taking the evidence of Israeli prior knowledge into consideration, with the Israeli military's capability to launch such a sophisticated false flag terror attack, the obvious question has to be asked. Would Israeli military agencies commit such an atrocious act of terrorism in the United States in order to achieve a strategic goal? The question whether Israeli strategic planners would conduct a false flag terror attack against the United States, their most powerful ally, in order to fix the blame on the Arabs, their enemies, raises several specific questions. 1. Has the Israeli military conducted false flag terror attacks against the United States in the past? 2. If so, are there links between the people or agencies involved in the previous terror attacks and 9/11? 3. Is there a strategic goal for which Zionist planners would commit such a terrorist atrocity? 4. If so, has that strategic goal been realized as a result of 9/11? The answer to all four questions is yes. The Israeli military has a documented history of conducting false flag terror attacks against the United States. It also has a history of withholding information from the United States about threats it had knowledge of. Specific Zionist extremists are, furthermore, the prime suspects with the strongest motives for carrying out 9/11. The Zionist motive was to kickstart their long-planned U.S.-led war on terror with a spectacular terror attack inside the United States. Like any other crime, solving 9/11 requires that we diligently investigate those suspects with strong motives and prior histories of committing similar crimes. There are Israeli suspects who fit this description. On the other hand, there is no reasonable Arab motive to attack the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Why would Arabs or Muslims commit such a counterproductive act? Why would any Arab organization commit a senseless crime, knowing that it would invite a U.S. military invasion of their nation or another Islamic nation? The Arab/Islamic terror scenario for 9/11 makes very little sense. Israel's history of terror. Quote, "We must use terror, assassination, intimidation, land confiscation, and the cutting of all social services to rid the Galilee of its Arab population." Close quote. David Ben-Gurion, first Prime Minister of Israel, to the General Staff, May 1948. Zionists and Israelis have long employed terrorism as a tool and a tactic. Senior officials of the Israeli government, the Mossad, and Amman, Israeli military intelligence, have long histories of using terror as a tool. Zionists from Poland and Russia used terrorism to drive the native Palestinians from their land, homes, and villages during the war of 1947 and 48. Some 400 Palestinian villages and towns were obliterated and their populations massacred or sent into exile as refugees. Many of the Palestinian houses and villages were taken over by Jewish immigrants. Others were razed to the ground. The Zionists also began using terrorism as a tactic against the West in the 1940s, carrying out false flag terror attacks against the United States and Britain as far back as the bombing of Jerusalem's King David Hotel on July 22, 1946. The bombing of the luxury hotel was ordered by Menachem Begin, the head of the Irgun, a Zionist terrorist organization during the 1930s and 1940s. Begin, a known terrorist, later became Prime Minister of Israel, a position he held during the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, which was led by Ariel Sharon, his defense minister. Begin, an avowed racist, had a Jewish supremacist view of the world, which he used to justify his crimes of terrorism and genocide. Quote, "The Palestinians are beasts walking on two legs," Begin said in a speech to the Knesset, as quoted by the Israeli writer Amnon Kapuliuk in his article Begin and the Beasts, published in the New Statesman of June 25, 1982. Zionist terrorists from the Irgun and Haganah militia, disguised as Arabs, set off seven large demolition bombs in the basement of the King David Hotel, which was the base for the British Secretariat and the military command in British-occupied Palestine. 91 people were killed, most of them staff of the Secretariat. The attack on the hotel was the deadliest attack against the British in the history of the Mandate. To this day, the Zionist bombing of the King David Hotel is the terrorist act which has caused the greatest number of casualties in the history of the Israeli-Arab conflict. Zionists are proud of the bombing as one of their key acts of terror that compelled the British to abandon Palestine. David Ben-Gurion, the head of the Haganah militia, advocated the use of terror and supported the bombing. Although publicly the Haganah condemned the bombing, many researchers insist that the Haganah had authorized it. Quote, "Everything was coordinated with the Haganah," Menachem Begin declared in a film from the Israeli Broadcasting Authority's Scroll of Fire series. Netanyahu's support for terrorists. Members of the Irgun, which carried out scores of terror bombings in the 1930s and 40s, and its political successors in the Likud party, hold the worldview that political violence and terrorism are legitimate tools in the Jewish national struggle for the land of Israel, according to Ari Perlinger and Leonard Weinberg, authors of Jewish Self-Defense and Terrorist Groups Prior to the Establishment of the State of Israel, Roots and Traditions. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister and leader of the Likud, attended a two-day anniversary celebration of the King David Hotel bombing in July 2006 with former terrorists of the Irgun and Haganah. The event was organized by the Menachem Begin Heritage House, the University of Haifa, and the Association of Itzel, or Irgun, Fighters. The seminar was held to mark the 60th anniversary of the bombing of the King David Hotel, Jerusalem, by members of the United Resistance Movement, Haganah and Irgun, the Jerusalem Post noted in its pre-event notices. The Israeli newspaper specifically noted that members of the Haganah and Irgun had been involved in the terrorist bombing. One of the terrorists even led a tour of the hotel he had bombed. The fact that the right-wing politician and terror specialist Bibi Netanyahu had participated in a two-day event celebrating the bombing of the King David Hotel was reported in the Jerusalem Post and in leading newspapers in Britain, France, and India. But not a single word about the event was printed in the controlled press of the United States, the nation supposedly fighting the war on terror. Netanyahu's conspicuous role as the main speaker at an event celebrating an act of terrorism was not reported in any U.S. newspaper until Patrick Buchanan mentioned it in his article entitled Moral Culpability for Kana on August 2, 2006. Buchanan's comments, however, only appeared in independent regional newspapers in Pittsburgh, Wyoming, and Ohio. Quote, "Rubbing our noses in our own cravenness, Bibi Netanyahu took time out a week ago to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the terror attack on the King David Hotel by Menachem Begin's Irgun, an attack that killed 92 people, among them British nurses. This was not a terrorist act," Bibi explained, "because Irgun telephoned a 15-minute warning to the hotel before the bombings went off." Right. And those children in Kana should not have ignored Israeli leaflets warning them to clear out of southern Lebanon. Our Israeli friends appear to be playing us for fools. Close quote. In 1946, The Times described the Irgun as terrorists in disguise. Sarah Agassi, it reported, was one of the terrorists in disguise involved in the bombing of the King David Hotel. She and a fellow agent had cased the hotel, while her brother and other terrorists had disguised themselves as Arabs delivering milk as they placed seven milk cans, each containing 50 kilograms, 110 pounds, of explosives in its basement. The Zionists had important strategic reasons for the bombing, according to the Jerusalem Post of July 27, 2006. Quote, "The bombing was a direct response to the events of the British Operation Agatha and the Black Sabbath of June 29, 1946, during which 17,000 British soldiers confiscated weapons and intelligence documents and arrested thousands of leaders of the Yishuv and Haganah activists. The documents brought to the King David headquarters revealed most of the Yishuv's operational plans and incriminated the Jewish agency in the leadership of the United Resistance, as well as the Itzel and the Lehi, against the British. The evidence would be used to try the Jewish activists and, quite possibly, to hang them. 25 leaders took part in the carefully planned and precisely executed bombing. 6 of them, dressed as Arab laborers, placed the 7 milk cans filled with 350 kilograms of explosives, fitted with timers set to go off in 40 minutes around the central support beam of the hotel's southern wing. Others spread explosives along the roads leading to the hotel to prevent reinforcements and emergency medical crews from arriving at the scene. Netanyahu's terrorist roots. Netanyahu is the son of Ben-Zion Netanyahu, born Milikovsky in Warsaw, Poland. Ben-Zion was the former senior aide of Vladimir Jabotinsky, the militant extremist founder of revisionist Zionism and the Irgun. His son, Benjamin Netanyahu, is also a leading advocate of the teachings of Jabotinsky. On July 8, 2007, Netanyahu was the keynote speaker at an event at the Jabotinsky Institute to mark the 67th anniversary of the death of the founder of the Irgun. The Irgun, a Zionist terrorist organization dedicated to creating Greater Israel, is the political parent of Israel's extreme right-wing Likud party, which Benjamin Netanyahu currently heads. The Irgun was the armed expression of revisionist Zionism, which was expressed by Jabotinsky as follows, according to Howard Sacher, author of A History of Israel, From the Rise of Zionism to Our Time. 1. Every Jew has the right to enter Palestine. 2. Only active retaliation, that is, terrorism, would deter the Arabs and the British. 3. Only Jewish armed force would ensure the Jewish state. Terrorism specialist. Netanyahu is also a terrorism specialist who has made a career out of promoting the Zionist agenda of a global war on terror since the 1980s. When Netanyahu was asked on the same day about the terrorism of 9/11, he said, "It's very good." Who else but a hardened terrorist complicit in the crime would use the word good to describe 9/11? As James Bennett of the New York Times reported on September 12, 2001, quote, "Asked tonight what the attack meant for relations between the United States and Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister, replied, 'It's very good.' Then he edited himself, 'Well, not very good, but it will generate immediate sympathy.'" Close quote. In 2006, the Jerusalem Post and other newspapers reported on Netanyahu's outspoken support for the terrorists who had bombed the King David Hotel in 1946. The Irgun's chief of operations at the time of the bombing was Eitan Livni, father of the Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, from 2006 to 2009. The high-level political connections in Israel with the Irgun terrorists of the 1940s are an indication of the influence they have on the Israeli political establishment. The Hindu noted in an article entitled "Celebrating Terror, Israeli Style," on July 24, 2006. Quote, "We do not think that it is right for an act of terrorism, which led to the loss of many lives, to be commemorated," Britain's ambassador to Israel, Simon MacDonald, and its consul general in Jerusalem, John Jenkins, protested weekly in a letter to the local Israeli administration in Jerusalem. Close quote. Previous Israeli attacks on U.S. targets. 8 years after the bombing of the King David Hotel, Israel carried out a series of false flag terror bombings against U.S. and British libraries, theaters, and other government institutions in Egypt in a terror campaign designed to be blamed on Egyptian groups. This Israeli terror campaign of July 1954 is often referred to as the Lavon Affair, after Pinhas Lavon, the Israeli defense minister at the time. In June 1967, 13 years after the Lavon affair, the Israeli Air Force and Navy deliberately strafed, bombed, napalmed, and torpedoed an unarmed U.S. vessel, the USS Liberty, and tried to kill all of its nearly 300 crew members simply to achieve a strategic goal. Recently released documents from the National Security Agency confirm that the United States government at the time had evidence that the Israelis had deliberately attacked the USS Liberty, knowing it was a U.S. vessel. Oliver Kirby, the NSA's deputy director for operations at the time of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, confirmed the existence of the transcripts to John Crudston of the Chicago Tribune in 2007, saying he had personally read them. Quote, asked whether he had personally read such transcripts, Kirby replied, "I sure did. I certainly did." They said, "We've got him in the zero," Kirby recalled, whatever that meant, I guess the sights or something. And then one of them said, "Can you see the flag?" They said, "Yes, it's U.S., it's U.S." They said it several times, so there wasn't any doubt in anybody's mind that they knew it. Kirby, now 86 years old and retired in Texas, said the transcripts were something that's bothered me all my life. I'm willing to swear on a stack of Bibles that we knew they knew. Close quote.
And that is where we have to leave it this week, due to time. If you'd like to download this or any other episode of Unwelcome Guests, you can do so from our download page, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you're new to 9/11, we have approximately 50 episodes on this topic, including one special edition, that's Unwelcome Guests number 568, which I particularly tried to make addressable for newcomers to the topic. Our theme tune is The Unwelcome Guest by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Let me close with a special thanks to Chris Berlin for writing this book and for making the audiobook and publishing it freely on the internet.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on the Armenian Holocaust. The ongoing controversy about the Armenian genocide. When on June 2, 2016, the German parliament overwhelmingly adopted a resolution declaring the killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks in 1915 a genocide, the Turkish government angrily denounced the vote as null and void, and Prime Minister Erdogan called his ambassador in Germany back for consultations. Fear spread among German political leaders that Erdogan might retaliate and unleash tens of thousands of refugees that Turkey currently hosts. Robert Fisk is the award-winning Middle East correspondent of the London Independent. He has reported from the Middle East since 1976, speaks Arabic, and lives in Beirut, Lebanon. Fisk wrote on June 2, 2016 in the Independent that Germany now joined France and Russia and at least 18 other nations who accept the Armenian genocide as a fact of history, along with Pope Francis, with the U.S. remaining the sole major exception. Fisk was the only journalist who pointed out that the refugees and migrants who Europe tries to keep out come in many cases from the very towns and deserts in which the Turks committed their acts of horror against the Armenians 101 years ago. Fisk goes on to write that the skulls and bones of Armenians still lie in the sands south of the Turkish border, which ISIS now controls. And when al-Nusra captured parts of Deir ez-Zor, they blew up the Armenian cathedral of this Syrian city, took the bones of genocide victims from the vaults, and scattered them in the streets. End quote. In the context of these events, here is Robert Fisk, recorded in San Francisco after the 85th anniversary of the Armenian Holocaust, as he chooses to define it. He had just been attacked in the media for using that word.
3 days ago, my paper received this email from Mustafa Gulek of Ankara. It's to me, of course. Dear sir, I had no idea what bad feelings Mr. Fisk harbored until I read in your paper today the one-sided, ignorant rantings that one usually only hears from badly educated, ill-informed, and bloodthirsty third-generation U.S. Armenians. So obviously, ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot in common tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, 8 years ago, on a grey, cold, damp day in the first week of March of 1992, I walked the side of the hill of Hurghada, a place of black volcanic stones high above what had once been the valley of the Habur River in northern Syria. An old Armenian woman, Surbohi Parpasyan, she's dead now, had sent me here from her village 12 miles away. She thought, she said, she thought she remembered finding the bones of Armenians below the hill of Hurghada 77 years earlier. She was looking for the bones of her sisters and father. So I had gone to Hurghada, found the hill, realized that the river had changed course over the decades, and I wandered down the hillside in the steady rain. It had poured rain so much over the previous weekend that small streams had opened fissures in the hillside. It was almost at the bottom that we saw what we suspected all along lay in this volcanic earth, a mass of skulls and bones embedded in a wall of earth on the side of a crack in the hill. I used my car keys to scrape away the mud, and the bones began to fall out of the earth into my own hands. Rib cages, femurs, an entire skeleton, then another and a third, so closely packed that the bones had become tangled with each other. There were sets of teeth, fibula, eye sockets, tightly squeezed together as they had been on the day they had died in terror in 1915, roped together to die in their thousands. Each skull became clammy as I held it in my hand, and its first contact with the air since the Armenian genocide, they began to become soft and disintegrate. The teeth were clean, undamaged, the teeth of young people, children, teenagers. My Armenian companion and his little boy held one of the skulls. "It is finished," he said. We later handed these bones to the Armenian church in Deir ez-Zor for proper burial. Yes, the evidence of the 20th century's first Holocaust, and yes, I call it a Holocaust, not an Armenian claim, lies under those desert sands of northern Syria. Countless thousands of those skeletons, of course, lie beneath Hurghada and beneath the fields and riverbanks of Turkey. Further north, up the Habur River, I came across caves with bones inside. Armenians there remember that this is where their ancestors were driven below ground and asphyxiated with the smoke of bonfires. They were, of course, the world's first primitive gas chambers. But my Armenian friend, I think, was wrong. It is not finished. For I believe, after 25 years watching the tragedy of the modern-day Middle East, that history cannot be buried or denied beneath the earth. As long as a people cannot receive acknowledgement of their torment, it is never finished. Until the history books are accepted and honoured as true, the story has not ended. The Holocaust, which began the 20th century, happens to have taken place in the lands that I now cover as a correspondent. Indeed, with my frequent visits to the Balkans, I sometimes think I must be the Ottoman correspondent of The Independent rather than the Middle East. So the Armenians met their fate in the lands I now regularly visit and on which I report. So how come, I found myself thinking, how come, not long after I arrived in the Middle East, how come that the first act of genocide was so often referred to as a claim, when the second great act of genocide, the Jewish Holocaust, was accepted as a terrible fact of history? Of course, we all know that Hitler, before planning the slaughter of Europe's Jews, asked if anyone still remembered the Armenians. But is there any excuse for us to cast doubt on what happened to the Armenians? Is this any reason for the Armenians to be virtually excluded, as they virtually were, from Britain's Holocaust Day memorial in January? What was the BBC, and I have the letter here, what was the BBC producer Daniel Britton Kaplan doing, writing to an Armenian group in France last 16th January? BBC coverage, he wrote, and here's the letter, is likely to include reference to, albeit briefly, the Armenian genocide. I liked the albeit briefly bit. So briefly perhaps, that the deniers and revisionists of the Armenian Holocaust might not notice the BBC's puny supply of courage in making any reference to 1.5 million murdered Armenians at all. Of course, I know, and we all know in this room, of the Turkish lobby groups which perpetuate the myth that there was no Armenian genocide, that your ancestors died in a civil war in which Turks died in even greater numbers. We all know about the economic sanctions levied on France after President Chirac signed the document acknowledging the Armenian genocide. We know how Britain, my country, fears to lose its own economic contracts in Turkey. And we know surely, as indeed we do, of the extraordinary, in other circumstances, I would say bizarre way in which President Clinton persuaded your lawmakers not to acknowledge the Armenian Holocaust because he said it might put American lives and interests at risk. What was he thinking? That an American genocide might follow the Armenian genocide? What was this great danger? What would have happened, for example, if today's Germany had threatened economic penalties, if any acknowledgement was made of the Jewish Holocaust? Would Mr. Clinton have made the same incredible statement? Of course not. But let's turn to my own profession, journalism. How is it that we free people, we reporters, we who are supposed to be the first witnesses of history, play a double standard over the Armenian and Jewish Holocausts? How can we lend credence to one group of deniers while rightly denouncing the other group as right-wing fanatics? Let me take, for example, a New York Times report of the 26th of March 1988 about those few Armenians, 70,000 in all, who survive in present-day Turkey. Here now is a key paragraph from that report by the New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer. Please do not chuckle at various points. Listen to these words. Relations between Turks and Armenians were good during much of the Ottoman period, but they were deeply scarred by massacres of Armenians by pro-Ottoman forces in eastern Anatolia carried out in the spring of 1915. Details of what happened there are still hotly debated. I told you not to do that. But it is clear that vast numbers of Armenians were killed or left to die during forced marches in a burst of what is now called ethnic cleansing. Now, I have, ladies and gentlemen, a serious problem with that paragraph. First of all, the figure of 1.5 million Armenians, or even 1 million Armenians, the all-important statistic that puts you in the genocide bracket, indeed marks the Armenians as victims of the first Holocaust, has totally disappeared from the record. It's not in that paragraph. We are left with what Mr. Kinzer calls vast numbers of killed, which keeps the New York Times out of harm's way with the Turks. Then genocide is reduced, you'll notice, to what Mr. Kinzer calls ethnic cleansing, a phrase familiar to us from the Serb war against the Muslims of Bosnia and against the Albanians of Kosovo, but on an infinitely less terrible scale than the massacres of 1915. So 1.5 million has been deleted, and we've lowered the potency of what actually happened. And note the reference to pro-Ottoman forces, not even Ottoman forces, and certainly not Turks. Note that the word Turks is not used in reference to the killers at all. Then we are told that the issue is hotly debated. How very fair of the New York Times to remind us so tamely that a campaign exists to deny the truth of the Armenian Holocaust. It's a lie every bit as evil, in my view, as those who wickedly claim that the Jewish Holocaust never happened. What am I as a journalist to make of this? Did I imagine all those bones tumbling into my hands in northern Syria? Were they not real? And what am I to make of this headline? This headline from the same series on another of Mr. Kinzer's articles. Armenia never forgets. Maybe it should. You missed that at the time. Now let me speak frankly. I think the New York Times reporter didn't want to offend the present Turkish government. He didn't want his feature article to be called controversial. He didn't want to stir things up. So he softened the truth, and the Turkish government must have been delighted. Now let's apply a simple test. Let's turn to that later and more numerically terrible Holocaust, that of the Jews of Europe. Would Mr. Kinzer have written in the same way about that mass slaughter? Would he have told us that German-Jewish relations were merely deeply scarred by the Nazi slaughter? Would he have suggested, even for a moment, that the details were hotly debated? No, he would not. But Mr. Kinzer did raise doubts about the Armenian Holocaust. He called it hotly debated. I have written frequently of the Armenian slaughter, and I did so again at the beginning of last year. I had been deeply moved by a meeting I had with a 101-year-old blind Armenian in the Armenian Old People's Home in Beirut. He was called Hatun, and he remembered how in the Syrian desert in 1915 his mother pleaded with Turks not to rape her 18-year-old daughter, Hatun's sister. As she begged them not to take my sister, they beat her to death, he told me. I remember her dying, shouting, Hatun, 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 over and over. When she was dead, they took my sister away on a horse. I never saw her again. Then, after years of bitterness and longing for revenge, what Hatun called his Christian belief overcame him, and he decided to abandon the notion of revenge. When the Turkish earthquake killed so many people, he told me, I prayed for the poor Turkish people. In my article in which I wrote of Hatun, I used a capital H in my reference to both the Armenian and Jewish Holocausts. I believe that capital H should be attached to all Holocausts. Little could I have guessed how quickly the dead would rise from their graves. For when my article appeared in my paper, a paper which has never failed to dig into human wickedness visited upon every race and creed, my reference to the Jewish Holocaust remained with a capital H, but the Armenian Holocaust had been downgraded to a little h. Tell me, Robert, my Armenian friend asked me, tell me, didn't the Turks kill enough of us? Of course, I at once investigated what had happened. There are no conspiracies on the independent sub-editor's desk. Just a no-nonsense rule that our articles follow what is called a house style. Through common usage, as it's called, I love that word, common usage, the Jewish Holocaust takes a capital H, other Holocausts don't. No one is quite sure why, though the practice has been followed in books and articles worldwide. The Jewish Holocaust should be capitalized, I said, not because its victims were European Jews or that of any other race, but because its victims were human beings. It was, after all, the Independent's editorial policy, my paper's policy, that the world must fight against all atrocities, that we should never accept the idea that one group of victims had special status over the other. When Armenians in Israel speak of their people's suffering, they use the Hebrew word Shoah, which means Holocaust. Common usage, I said, can't decide morality. And so the Independent then ran an article by a Turkish Cypriot academic denouncing my own report on the Armenians, but on top of his article, we used the words Armenian Holocaust with a capital H, and so we always have since. The Turks did not complain. The world did not end. There was an Armenian Holocaust. Those skulls I found in the desert were real. But you should not believe that the debate over the Armenian genocide does not take place inside Turkey. It does. I have several good Turkish friends who tell me privately that they believe there was a genocide, that Ottoman Turkey was responsible, and the statistics are right. One of these Turks is a senior government civil servant in Ankara. In the newspaper Milliyet, the journalist Yavuz Baydar was quoted as saying that, "I was always convinced of the necessity to show courage and to take to task Talat and company for their misdeeds. These men are our Pol Pots, Beria's and Stalin's, and the sooner we call their crimes to account, the better our chances of redeeming ourselves from this scourge of being accused of genocide." Dr. Taner Akçam, author of several Armenian studies, said, and I quote, "The constant refrain of we Turks are not guilty and the parallel blaming of the Armenians, who are the victims, very much hurts the cause of Turkey. Unless we distance ourselves from the perpetrators of this crime, which was a genocide, soykırım in Turkish, we will never be able to relieve ourselves of this terrible burden. The destruction of the Armenians is a historical fact organized by the government of the day. Ask for forgiveness from the Armenian people and make a commitment that in Turkey, political dissent and disagreement should no longer be treated as an offense." Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you an important question. It's not a proposal. I'm a newspaper reporter, and nothing I'm saying to you tonight I haven't written in my paper or spoken of before. But it's a question I'd like to put to you. In Israel, they honour the non-Jewish men and women who tried or succeeded in saving the lives of the Jewish victims of the Jewish Holocaust. They include people of every nation. They honour what they call the righteous Gentile. And I've always thought this a fine idea. And I've wondered from time to time, I'm just asking this question, why you haven't thought of doing the same. I don't just mean thanking the foreigners, the German missionaries, the Swiss, the Dutch, the English and American teachers, the French and British and American navies, the saviours of the people of Musa Dagh. No, I'm thinking of those examples. I've heard about them from ageing survivors, and I've come across them in contemporary documents. I'm thinking of those people who tried to help your ancestors and who were Turks. I'm talking about the good Turks, the very occasional Ottoman official who was appalled at the atrocities committed against the Armenian people, the Turkish or Kurdish villager whose courage stood out when his own people were turning so brutally against your ancestors. Many of you will remember from your school books, I think, the story of Jalal Pasha, I think it was, of the Wali of Aleppo, who said he was a governor, not an executioner, and thus saved thousands of Armenian lives. It was he who said that it is the natural right of a human being to live. The Armenians will defend themselves. In September 1915, Rahmi Bey of Smyrna was reported as saying he would not expel the Armenians. Also Hajadil of Adrianople. Then there is Ismail Kemal Bey, an Albanian and governor who was dismissed because he refused the genocide orders of the Turkish Committee of Union and Progress. Then there are the little men. Zakhar Beberyan was 12 when the Turkish army and gendarmerie came to Marash in 1915. Before he died in Beirut, he told me how he saw babies being dropped on the roadway by Turkish gendarmes, how if they survived, their brains would be beaten on the road, how his parents died of cholera. "I should have died," he added, "but a Turk gave me food to survive." Indeed, in almost every interview I conducted at that time, Armenian survivors would recall few but individual Turks who, driven by their Muslim religion or common humanity, disobeyed the fascistic orders of the rulers in Constantinople and sheltered Armenians in their homes. You can find their ghosts even in the great Bryce Report on the Armenian Genocide, published by the British Foreign Office in 1916, a volume unlikely to have recorded the good deeds of Turks or Kurds or Arabs, had they not been true. An Armenian report included in a State Department dispatch of the 17th of September 1915, for example, quotes a report from Arab deputies from Baghdad and Syria who recall that the railway to Aleppo discharges into the mountains vast numbers of Armenians who are abandoned there without bread or water. In the towns and villages, the Arabs try to bring them some relief. A statement by the Reverend William Shedd of the Presbyterian Mission during the Urmia massacres of January 1915, after describing the vile treatment of civilians at the hands of Turkish troops and militias who participated in the worst of the slaughter, records that there were many villagers who showed only kindness. The Persian governor made it possible by his cooperation for the American missionaries to do what they did. The Kurds responded to appeals for mercy, and in some cases returned captive girls unsolicited and did other humane service. A few individual Turkish officers and a number of their soldiers took strong measures to keep order. One such officer saved the city from loot when riot had already begun. There are other examples in the Bryce records and elsewhere of such humane behaviour by men who clearly disobeyed the orders of their brutal masters. So terrible was the year 1915 in the Armenian lands under Turkish control and in the deserts of northern Syria, and so wicked were the Turkish authorities of the time, that I think it is necessary to remember that Muslims, including brave Turks, sometimes risked their lives for your doomed ancestors. And so I ask again why the descendants of those Armenians don't acknowledge in some form that courage. Armenians demand that the Turks acknowledge their Holocaust. The Turkish authorities still call it a myth. But how would they react to an Armenian demarche to remember the Turks who showed bravery and honour during that time of atrocities? Those Turks may be painfully few in number, but you would be showing modern-day Turkey that you acknowledge the humanity of some of their former citizens. How would the Turks react to such a gesture? By refusing to honour their own brave Turks? Or would they remember the courage of those Turks and by the same token accept the fact of the Armenian genocide? It's only a question I'm asking. Corporal Omer would be remembered, and the Turk who gave 12-year-old Zakhar Beberyan food. So would Jalal Pasha of Aleppo. And it might be a very small step in the story of the Syrian desert, of those skulls which prompted my Armenian friend to say, "It is finished," when, in my view, for the historical record, the story has still not ended. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for the invitation to address you tonight and for your patience in listening to me.
That was the journalist and Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, Robert Fisk.
You're listening to CIUT at 9.5 FM, the Taylor Report, and we're going to hear a little bit more of this wonderful guy, Muhammad Ali, singing with another guy named Sam Cooke, and then we'll be back with Ishmael Reed.
As you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here. And Sam and I, we expect to have this out in another week or so.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Well, I want to give you a little introduction. Only this record is talking about, you know, me, the greatest, and the various people in countries such as England and Paris. And we'll give them a sound.
Come on, let's give them a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We'll try now.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Do it again now.
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one.
Is New York with me?
Yeah!
Is Chicago with me?
Yeah!
Is London with me?
Yeah!
Hey, hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, hey, the gang's all here. We gonna swing as one.
How you like that?
I like it a lot. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT at 9.5 FM. And we are joined now by Ishmael Reed. He's the author of The Complete Muhammad Ali and many other books. I'd call him the reigning defending champion of African-American literature. Ishmael Reed, are you there?
Yes, I am, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. You have written a really important article. Of course, this book, I'm really glad that this is the core of our discussion because you've written an op-ed piece in the New York Times, published June 4th, titled Muhammad Ali, Worshipped, Misunderstood, and exploited. And just one note I want to make before we talk about him as a champion and the earthquake that's caused by his passing, cultural earthquake. There's a story told about his life that his father once came when he was 14 years old and came into his room in the middle of the night and announced that Emmett Till was the same age as as his son. And the son said he was haunted by that. He was shocked by it. And you wrote to me a book that every American ought to have by his bedside, Reckless Eyeballing, in which the lynching of Emmett Till is treated. And it is really that topic needs to be talked about. But this is before there's a champion, before he's a great athlete, all these things, Emmett Till. What kind of place was he growing up in, and how important is that? It ties your book, him, and I think a whole generation of people.
I think that many black intellectuals, I'm not calling it, but many black, sensitive blacks growing up in the South became aware of the contradictions and hypocrisy. And County Cullen wrote a poem called The Baltimore Moment. Mm-hmm. When he went to Baltimore, all he could remember was a white kid calling him by the N-word. Mm-hmm. And all of us have our Baltimore moment. For example, for me, it was when I was a child. My mother was very attractive, very beautiful woman. Well-dressed, and always very meticulous in her appearance, took me to, I think it was Lookout Mountain or Signal Mountain in Chattanooga. And I was drinking from a water fountain, and she pulled me away from the water fountain. And I didn't understand what that was all about, that, you know, this was a white-only water fountain. So, you know, kids like that, like Ali and me, begin to question these contradictions. And what happened with Muhammad Ali was he joined the Nation of Islam because he felt that the Nation of Islam provided him with answers and a history.
Mm-hmm. And one other echo in that incident, and I read this now. This is we're talking about yesterday's newspapers. I'm reading all of them. I bet so many thousands of people, millions of people, were reading every paper about Muhammad Ali. And one of the stories was that his father, they said, told him about Emmett Till and talked to him. But here's the quotes, the phrase, filled his head with ideas about Marcus Garvey. I wish I had not seen that in a newspaper, 2016. Filled his head. What would I wonder what that reporter wanted them to fill his head with.
Well, Marcus Garvey is another boogeyman, black boogeyman. As a matter of fact, I got into a dispute with a show here called Boardwalk Empire. Boardwalk Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I think Martin Scorsese had a hand in this. And there was one scene where Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association was associated with dope dealing. I wrote the producers and told them that Marcus Garvey had nothing to do with selling drugs and that his was one of the big mass movements among African Americans in American history. So they said, well, they relied upon an actor, one of these actors in the series who told them that history, but it was not on solid ground. So we had a dispute about that, which reached the Wall Street Journal, where the Wall Street Journal went and asked these producers to back that up, and they couldn't. They couldn't back up the association with associating with Marcus Garvey with drugs. Then they said it was, well, it was this West Indian numbers man. Well, this the West Indian numbers man whom they mentioned was not involved in drugs anyway. So I think they're very sloppy with the way they characterize people like Elijah Muhammad and Marcus Garvey. They make them into boogeymen. I just had a dispute on the radio today with a sports writer who was sort of like trying to demonize the Nation of Islam. So I think that's the kind of hazard you have. What you have here, and ironically, I found that Colin Blank, my partner, and I have been to China a couple of times, and they know more about African-American culture in China and Europe and other places than the United States.
Somehow, I'm not surprised. The subject of colonialism and the colonization of black Americans in many ways would make that an affinity, right?
Well, what you have here is the settler population. People who are second, third generation are really not at home here. Matter of fact, Chief Seattle of the Washington Indians said that, you know, the Europeans might not be, ever be at home here. And so they're always afraid of so-called underclass, or the native, the 19th century is Native Americans. This century is African Americans and Muslims and Mexicans and everything. There's always a fear that they will get the upper hand. Second Amendment's all about. You know, they talk a lot of BS about the Second Amendment on in the media, but they want you know, to have their guns in case there's an armed uprising or whatever.
Yeah, so, Thomas Jefferson said they had a wolf by the ear.
Yeah, that's the kind of paranoia that's sweeping the country. And it's led to this halfwit being nominated for the Republican Party. They don't know what to do with him because he's nuts. And but he's a culmination of what they've been trying to do, their strategies for a decade. I'm glad to see it retired the Bush family because they're the ones who came up with this Willie Horton stuff and this racism. Among, you know, others. So this is what Ali had to face when he joined the Nation of Islam because, you know, the establishment is used to their black people being Christians.
Yes, that's been an element. The Islamic element is that they were getting out of control by Christians, in a sense, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
there's some of that. He really scared them that he had found a religion which was very big in Africa and the Middle East, and it didn't belong to them.
Yeah, well, they were fearful of the Nation of Islam until they found that their values were actually conservative, and that they were capitalists, like you know, which is the economic system in this country, prevailing economic system. So first, the FBI gave them problems. As a matter of fact, they used to infiltrate Nation of Islam meetings in blackface. But they were easily identified. But finally, when Elijah Muhammad died, he was praised by the establishment, by the Washington establishment, because if somebody tells you that they want to separate and take blacks and tell them to go somewhere, there are a lot of people who are all for that. That's why, you know, the Nazi Party and the Klan sometimes attended the Nation of Islam's meetings.
And I'll just tell everybody, this is Ishmael Reed. The book is The Complete Muhammad Ali, and it is indeed The Complete Muhammad Ali, and it couldn't be a better time to be talking about the book and to Ishmael Reed. Let's just establish the fact that the term the greatest, speaking of him as a boxer, is that where you place him?
I think that's open to dispute. I think maybe Joe Louis said that Sonny Liston was the greatest heavyweight champion of all time. But he was an underclass person who was born in near slavery, one of 24 children, beaten every day by his father, escaped and went to St. Louis to be with his mother. She wanted to know why he showed up. So that's the kind of history he had.
And yeah.
Plus, he was of dark complexion. There's also a racial caste thing to this thing. When they talk about Ali's beauty, sometimes it's, you know, something has to do with their opinion about his, or their assessment of his European heritage, his Irish heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that in it where he would call darker-skinned boxers like Joe Frazier gorillas and all that,
mm-hmm.
which are always in racist descriptions. So, mm-hmm. I mean, he's very complicated, a complicated person, but I think for my money, I think Sugar Ray Robinson would rank as the greatest fighter of all time.
Oh, thank you. I'm taking my hat off to that.
And
he trained. That's who Muhammad Ali went to learn how, right? I mean, when he was turning pro, it was Sugar Ray.
They parted because Sugar Ray Robinson Jr. told me, his dad was All-American patriot, and he couldn't understand why, you know, Ali would join the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an incident where, shall we say, Muhammad Ali was disciplining his first wife,
mm-hmm.
and Sugar Ray Robinson tried to intervene, and Muhammad Ali threatened him. So when he joined the Nation of Islam, that was a parting of the ways
mm-hmm.
with Sugar Ray Robinson and some of the other some of his other reporters. Now, the Nation of Islam informed him about black history and lifted his consciousness, but there was a negative side to it also, because they did use some of his comic book ideas, like mad scientists creating white people and all that. And ironically, what I found out, talking to people who were inside the mansion with Elijah Muhammad, he had dinner with white people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He had one of his closest friend was a Jewish guy named Cup. There was a guy named Cup who had some kind of radio show in Chicago.
Yeah.
So he would sit at the table for hours and harangue his guests and everything. Mm-hmm. He was a pragmatist. He was a businessman. He dealt with all kinds of people. So, mm-hmm. But I think the artists and intellectuals in New York at the time, some of my friends, they went off the deep end with this stuff and actually believed it literally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what he said, I asked one of the followers why they used that stuff, and he said, well, they couldn't teach the masses the Quran, so they had to come to them with, like, flying saucers and all this kind of stuff, spaceships and all this.
There's a few churches that are known for that.
Yeah, I know. I know the one you're talking about.
Who, you know, they're going to, it's got to be a show.
As a matter of fact, there's a rumor, I don't know if this is substantiated, that Minister Louis Farrakhan has joined up with Scientologists.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll keep our eye on that story.
But American, you know, American religion has been odd. You know, you have
homemade.
Homemade, absolutely homemade.
We got the Mormons, a very interesting group of people.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. This is Ishmael Reed, and the book is The Complete Muhammad Ali. You should have all the writings of Ishmael Reed, but particularly, I say, the novel, Reckless Eyeballing. What a brilliant book.
It sort of cast me into oblivion in this country.
Well, we know why.
Yeah, absolutely. But now there's a backlash on that group.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Phil, what I decided was that I would try global strategy, and I think it's working, where, I started learning Japanese, and because I wrote a book called Japanese by Spring.
Yes.
Been invited to China a couple times and Japan a couple times. And then, I studied Yoruba, and I went to Nigeria, and I'm studying Hindi now. So what happens are incidents like
this. Keep an eye on this space.
That's right. There was a conference in Switzerland where I performed with a group there, and it was reviewed in China. So my strategy is to, as a matter of fact, my books have been published in Canada.
Baraka books?
Absolutely, by Robin Philpott. Mm-hmm. Because no American publishers would touch these books because I'm not post-race. I'm not saying let's make nice and forget about everything. And I'm not in New York, so I'm not beholden to any kind of constituency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there is something here that linking to Ali, following his lead. He wanted to be the world's champion, and he did take that fight to Zaire. He went to Philippines. He said, and it, Malaysia, he wanted to be seen in a way that was an international strategy, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the same time, he had to hobnob with dictators.
Yep.
Mobutu was a terrible man. I mean, the Americans.
Well, the book business, except for Baraka Books, is pretty rough too.
Absolutely.
And boxing business isn't really a business. I mean, that is ugly.
Well, I think if anything positive would result from Muhammad Ali's death, maybe there would be a move to unionize boxers. But no, Eddie Mustafa Muhammad and the Teamsters were trying to work out something. And the late Jack Newfield was urging, and Teddy Atlas talks about this all the time.
Good.
That should be some kind of federal regulation. And one of those people who was very sympathetic to this idea is Senator McCain. Mm-hmm. So I think that in order for other boxers not to be almost murdered in the ring like Ali,
yes,
who fought his last, no matter what the adulation says today, they're all upset because I'm bringing this up. He fought the last two fights with brain damage.
Yes.
So in order for that to be avoided in the future, there should be some kind of protection for boxers, like a union, certain benefits that they would have,
Where you would have some rights and somebody else would enforce them. You don't have to call on your pal, the trainer, to save your life, or your pal, the doctor. It would actually be your organization saying, no, you're not fighting anymore.
That's right. These promoters, Golden Boy, Don King, and Bob Arum, they're destroying boxing.
Mm-hmm.
They're destroying the sport. At least when the mob control the boxing, you had to fight all comers.
Mm-hmm.
But now, they have certain telegenic boxers who draw crowds and they draw pay-per-view and television money, revenue, and they're protected. They get thrown in the ring with a guy who...
Mm-hmm.
Your opponent who's fighting a thing on 2 weeks' notice hadn't had a chance to train, or this is happening more and more.
And may have been knocked out in his last fight.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So these guys are destroying the sport.
Mm-hmm. This is Ishmael Reed. It's Muhammad Ali. The Complete Muhammad Ali is the book, and he's written in June 4, 2016, New York Times, Muhammad Ali Worshipped, Misunderstood, Exploited. And I have to ask you, there is a funeral coming up, and I'm seeing people that are going to be talking there, and I thought of the word exploited. Bill Clinton is going to talk.
He shouldn't show his face before black people. He's got a lot of nerve. I saw him at something called the opening of the Ali Center. First time I bought a $1,000 ticket for something. Mm-hmm. And it was just bizarre. It was really a farce where Muhammad Ali was there, in mm-hmm. a state of illness, and you had all these politicians and movie stars and all these people singing his praises, and one of them was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton put more black people in jail than any president in history.
Yes.
He's got Vietnamese-American families eating out of garbage cans because of that. They used to say black folks, we're the scapegoats for all things, all the social ills. Vietnamese-American families eating out of garbage cans because of that welfare reform. Thousands of millions of women, black white, yellow, brown, mm-hmm. are in difficulty because of that welfare reform bill. But all we hear about are these feminism has become so decadent. All we hear about are these university professors who are making maybe $150,000. You're talking about their triple oppression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to get that in there.
I was shocked by that. I mean, he's already had a second Sister Soldier moment. He went after these young women from Black Lives Matter and yeah. shouted at them. Really, it was just like he did with Sister Soldier.
Yeah, well, that's...
When I heard he was going to speak at the funeral, I thought the first word to hit at my head was necrophilia.
Well, you know, I was the first one to call him a black president in the Baltimore Sun, way before Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because, you know, people around the country I'd heard, and black people I visited in Hawaii at the time, talked about his black style. So I think he's used that black style to con the upper middle classes and upper classes of, you know, the black elite.
Yes.
Certainly good for them, but he's been bad for the so-called underclass.
Yeah, we spoke of Elijah Muhammad and people saying, oh, he wasn't on the up and up. Well, Bill Clinton... beats them all. He's a champ in that department.
They've had two musicals on Broadway honoring slave traders. So, you know, Elijah Muhammad, I mean, he's small potatoes if you're talking about somebody's morals.
Exactly.
The Atlantic Monthly has something in the last couple of days about my criticisms of this thing, Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
where this con artist, Louis Miranda,
mm-hmm.
says that promoted this myth that Hamilton was an abolitionist and a progressive. Not only did he trade slaves, but we have the letter where he talks about how much he paid for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what is going on Broadway. Then they had a thing called Bloody Bloody Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a guy who was sort of like the Himmler of Native American policy in
yes.
this country. The last revolution.
President Jackson.
Right. Called him Bloody Bloody Andrew. Mm-hmm. And this, he's still one of these official historians, John Meacham, who believes that the last time there was a grassroots movement was Shays Rebellion, you know, like ignoring 200 years of labor history,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, strikers are beaten up and murdered in the streets. Mm-hmm. He called Andrew Jackson a rock and roll star.
Oh, my God.
So that's how it's become down here in this country.
Well, this is Ishmael Reed, and you called him out. As far as you did it with Arthur Schlesinger Jr., you really shut his mouth, actually. He was a big Jackson man.
Well, he apologized.
Yeah, but you're the poet who brought him down. I've always noticed that poets get more done than historians.
I made that Times obituary. I was included in his obituary where I called him a follower of David Duke.
Yeah.
That was sort of like tongue-in-cheek because David Duke got his degree in history.
Yeah. Well, now,
you know.
Yeah. I got to ask you. It's very important to tell that the big moment, certainly, of courage in Ali that no one can quite explain is that being the heavyweight champion of the world, looking at millions of dollars coming his direction, said, no, I'm not going to serve in the Vietnam War. Where did he get what it took to do that? Can you tell us?
He got it from the Nation of Islam that they never get credit.
Yes.
I was telling David Kindred, he's one of the big sports writers. I was on NPR with him today, and I was telling him that the big flaw in some of the other biographies, they don't give a Nation of Islam. They have such problems with the Nation of Islam, referring to them as lunatics and fanatics and all that kind of stuff, that they do not realize that there's an antecedent for what Muhammad Ali did, and that he was inspired by his mentor and his father figure, Elijah Muhammad, who was a conscientious objector in World War II.
By the way, at a war that was harder to say no to.
Absolutely. You know, they just gave Tom Brokaw the Legion of Honor for his Greatest Generation thing.
Uh-huh.
This is a generation that sent black soldiers in the Italian campaign to the front without ammunition and had them ordered by or commanded by Southern officers who knew how to handle N-word, you know.
Yes.
Black people. So.
And in your town, Oakland, when there was a ship blew up, they sent the black workers
right.
in to
That's
pick
right.
up the shells.
That's
and
right.
when they said no, they charged them with mutiny.
Well, you know, we just had a memorial service for Johnny Williams, who died last year, and the memorial service was held last week without a single mention in the paper and everything. but he's one of our great novelists, and he's the one who exposed all that, the treatment of black soldiers in World War II and the other wars.
Well, thanks to Muhammad Ali's father and to you and to Muhammad Ali, we do know Muhammad Ali knew about all those things. It was in him.
He knew a lot, but sometimes he's a little naive. he got such great treatment in England that he doubted that the English ever fought a war.
Well, this is,
there were some gaps.
Well, this is, thank goodness we're talking to the man who knows about it, the complete Muhammad Ali, Ishmael Reed. Thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again.
Well, I think I'll be in Toronto at the end of the month. They're trying to work it out.
Okay. We look forward to it.
So I'll see you up there.
See ya.
Okay. Okay, take care.
Okay, no. Bye-bye. And that is Ishmael Reed. This has been the Taylor Report. And, honey, thank you very, very much. And we'll see you next week.